Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, February 26th, 2016. So I have been told. Final study session on Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. Walking right through up to the beginning of the Civil War, the election of Abraham Lincoln, and the conclusion of the text. Folks have any final remarks, kind of major themes that they will take away from the book, final impressions? This would be the time to get those out. Again, we are picking up in Chapter 10, Arms, 1850 through 1861, and we will be going right through to the conclusion of the text. Again, this is Edward Baptist. The half has never been told. Slavery and the making of American capitalism. Audio segment number one.
After returning to Illinois in 1849 from his single term in Congress, Lincoln had stepped back from the political whirl. But in 1854, news of Douglas's Kansas-Nebraska Act had rendered him thunderstruck. He helped organize the Illinois Republican Party, and, freed from the need of cooperating with Southern Whigs, he found his distinctive voice. He began to insist, in every speech he gave, that the expansion of slavery would always escape the categories and compromises in which white America tried to contain and store it. The entrepreneurial destruction and recreation of everything that forced migration touched went beyond white abolitionists' moral critique of slavery as a sin. It went beyond the regional arrogance that insisted slavery was archaic, for, efficient or not, slavery had locked Southerners to the continued expansion of the institution. "We would be as they were," he warned Northerners, "were all our wealth invested directly in the cotton machine." What was now happening, Lincoln insisted, was that in order to protect slavery's future growth, the principles and institutions which had offered people like Lincoln opportunities for freedom, unprecedented in the history of ordinary tillers of soil and hewers of trees, were being twisted. "Shut every door and arm every bolt, and you would replace possibilities still undreamed with slavery everlasting." Immeasurable misery was the future for those locked in the prison house. And for the millions of people around the globe who hoped the modern world would bring liberation from ancient tyrannies, the death of the promise of freedom for all in the United States meant the death of the world's hopes for liberation. Lincoln's fears might have come true. Many factors already rendered the situation of Southern expansionists more promising than at any point since 1837. Support for national expansion remained high, and an unparalleled stretch of economic prosperity sustained enslavers' revenues at previously unimagined heights. Enslavers had in their pocket an opinion from the Supreme Court and an act of Congress, Kansas-Nebraska, that opened new possibilities. Democrats, North and South, could have been satisfied to lay the Dred Scott decision as the last brick on a constitutional and political economic edifice that ended the debate about the expansion of slavery. That could have left the democracy, the Democratic Party, as the dominant national political organization. Once the mechanism of 4 million locks were armed, the entire array of defenses against freedom might never have been unlocked. Yet once again, as in 1837, the overuse of leverage, this time political rather than financial, created a disastrous outcome for Southern enslavers. In the summer of 1857, Kansas had held an election for delegates to a constitutional convention. The Free State majority boycotted the election, while Missourians again poured over the border to vote illegally. Of 19,000 actual male residents, 85% did not cast ballots. So when 60 delegates assembled in October 1857 at the town of Lecompton, all 60 were pro-slavery. They proceeded to write the most pro-slavery state constitution in U.S. history. Its Article 7 parroted the Calhounian doctrine. The right of property is before and higher than any constitutional sanctions, and the right of the owner of a slave to such slave and its increases is the same and as inviolable as the right of the owner to any property whatsoever. Number 23 in the Constitution's Bill of Rights read, "Free Negroes shall not be permitted to live in this state under any circumstance." The convention decreed that the 200-odd slaves already in Kansas could never be freed, even by constitutional amendment. Free Staters boycotted the ratification ballot as well, and the pro-slavery voters who participated approved the Lecompton Constitution by a tally of 6,000 to 600. As Northerners watched this travesty unfold each day on the pages of their Telegraph-updated newspapers, Southern Democrats pressed for an instant congressional acceptance of the undemocratic document, which would be the last step in confirming Kansas as a slave state. The Buchanan administration fell humbly into line. But Northern Democrats, led by Stephen Douglas, realized that the Lecompton fraud rendered absurd their previous claim that the popular sovereignty idea they'd used to sell the Kansas-Nebraska bill was about giving the choice to the voter. If these Democrats wanted to win elections in Illinois, New York, or New Hampshire, they had to repudiate Lecompton. Douglas knew he was fighting for his political life. He turned his thunderous energy against the Democrats who were loyal to Buchanan and his pro-Southern administration. At the same time that the Democratic Party began to scratch and claw itself to pieces in Congress, the fighting in Kansas began to generate economic fallout. The number of immigrants riding the rails west through Chicago toward Kansas plummeted from 100,000 in 1856 to 10,000 in 1858. The market for Kansas land warrants vanished, imploding speculative schemes, while railroad stocks plunged in price. Major northern banks collapsed under the weight of failed investments in both. The collapses became the Panic of 1857, which put hundreds of thousands out of work in the North. Yet factors continued to buy Southern cotton because international demand remained high. Remembering how Northern debt collectors had wagged their fingers during the 1840s, pro-slavery writers chortled that this time, the slave labor staples of the South will furnish the means for extrication from commercial indebtedness. Still, while Southern nationalists savored Schadenfreude, Republicans, true to their own dogma, insisted that somehow slave lords must have caused the panic. And Lecompton kept political wind in their sails. Northern Democrats up for re-election in 1858, including Stephen Douglas, were vulnerable. Abraham Lincoln decided to challenge Douglas for his Senate seat. Lincoln used the election to test his arguments, in particular, his claim that any policy that enabled further forced migration to occur, like Douglas's popular sovereignty, inevitably led to the subordination of all political and economic freedoms to the needs of enslavers. In the 7 Lincoln-Douglas debates of August to October 1858, the challenger grounded the anti-slavery argument on a foundation that held true whether the listener was an open racist, like David Wilmot, an abolitionist, or something in between. Lincoln insisted that slavery contradicted what he understood to be the fundamental truths of American identity, particularly the natural rights claims of the Declaration, If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. Lincoln acknowledged the difficulty of ending slavery in a day, a week, or a year. Slavery, he said, was like a gruesome, metastatic cancer growing on a man's neck. He dares not cut it out. He bleeds to death if he does, directly. Slavery, he said, was also like a rattlesnake that crawled into a bed where the children are sleeping. Would I do right to strike him there? It might hurt the children. Or the awakened serpent might bite the children. But leave it coiled in the bed, let the cancer grow, and the result was also death. Permit expansion, and as the past 70 years had shown, you deepen American slavery's severity, entrench more securely its immense pecuniary interest. For the Union, Lincoln insisted, cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. It will become all of one thing or the other. His ultimate opponents, the slavery expansionist politicians of the South, agreed with his analysis of slavery as a system that needed geographic growth in order to function. And, Lincoln warned, they would try to ensure that growth would happen by trying to turn the entire United States into slave territory. This would limit all Americans' rights, making people in the free states as subservient to the thought policing of pro-slavery orthodoxy as those in the South. Historians have dismissed the idea that slavery could have returned to the free states, but perhaps his claim was not implausible. At the Ottawa, Illinois debate, Lincoln asked, "What is necessary for the nationalization of slavery? It is simply the next Dred Scott decision. It is merely for the Supreme Court to decide that no state under the Constitution can exclude it, just as they have already decided that under the Constitution, neither Congress nor the territorial legislature can do it." Even as Lincoln and Douglas squabbled, the case of Lemon versus People of New York was moving toward the Supreme Court. In it, a Virginia slaveholder who was taking his slaves to Texas via New York protested that the latter state had violated his rights when it declared his slaves to be free because he had kept them in Manhattan during an extended visit. A Taney-led Supreme Court might well rule, on the broadest substantive due process grounds, that no state could deny slaveholding citizens of the United States the right to hold their human property. Lincoln acknowledged that most Northern whites were reluctant to imagine a society in which African Americans could claim the rights of the free, much less the rights of the equal. In recent years, Lincoln critics have cherry-picked quotations from these acknowledgments to prove that Lincoln was a racist. He did use cagey qualifications here, especially during the debates in Little Egypt in southern Illinois, where Douglas was particularly successful at using race baiting to fire up virulently anti-black crowds. But he stuck to his central points. Slavery undermined freedom's future for whites as well as blacks. It could not be allowed to expand, or it would go everywhere and change everything. Though its excision must not be rushed destructively, it must begin. And excision should begin with the defeat of the Douglas Democrats, who had long enabled Southern expansionists to get their way. Douglas fought both at home and in Washington to prove that the Northern wing of the Democratic Party had not been turned into a front by which enslavers defrauded Northerners of votes. Through late 1857 and the first part of 1858, Southerners in Congress and the supine Buchanan administration demanded a vote on Kansas's admission as a slave state under the Lecompton Constitution. Douglas and his loyalists among the Northern Democrats in Congress now made a stand. In April 1858, after a furious debate that featured a brawl between 30 congressmen, which, among other things, dislodged Mississippi Congressman William Barksdale's previously unsuspected toupee, the House rejected the Lecompton bill. The Senate insisted, over Buchanan's protests, on returning the proposed Constitution to the territory's actual residents for another opportunity to reject or ratify. In August, Free State Kansas voters, finally turning out to vote now that they had a fair chance, turned down the Lecompton Constitution. Douglas's stand against Lecompton held Illinois Democrats' votes to the party line in November 1858. The party eked out a narrow victory that translated into his re-election as U.S. Senator. But Southern Democratic strategists, seeing that powerful elements of the Northern wing were trying to muster enough defiance to preserve themselves, planned a test that would require either commitment to slavery's expansion or full-scale breakup of the National Party. In May 1858, pro-slavery Kansans murdered five settlers outside their cabins at a Free State settlement. John Brown responded with a raid into Missouri, killing one enslaver and carrying off 11 enslaved people to Canada. Early the next year, Brown went to Boston and met with a group of wealthy abolitionists who admired his Kansas work. They included his backer, Gerrit Smith, abolitionist Unitarian minister Theodore Parker, and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, the epitome of a Boston aristocrat. The Secret Six, as they call themselves, seduced by Brown's Old Testament prophet manner of carrying himself, agreed to support the plan he unfolded. Brown proposed that he and a group of raiders seize the federal armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, where the Blue Ridge Mountains meet the Potomac River. If he controlled the armory, Brown believed, slaves from 50 miles around would flock to his vanguard. The backers tingled vicariously, righteously. Here was a Northerner truly willing to meet Southern bullying with unblinking violence. They agreed to send Brown money and weapons, and he established a hideout near Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. From there, he began recruiting commandos, his sons, a dozen or so other white men, and five African Americans. The Secret Six also set up a secret meeting between the Scourge of Kansas and Frederick Douglass, the most prominent African American of the era. In a quarry outside of Chambersburg, Brown tried to persuade Douglass to join him. Douglass, whose 2 decades in slavery had given him a far more realistic understanding of enslavers' massive power, warned him that Kansas bushwhacking against soft targets, plus abolitionist propaganda, had led Brown and his backers to the unrealistic belief that slaveholding society would crumble easily. An abolitionist attack on the federal government not only was futile, but might turn public opinion against a movement that many Northern whites already saw as irresponsibly radical. On the evening of October 16, 1859, without Douglass, Brown and 18 warriors slipped into Harper's Ferry, a small town in Virginia, now West Virginia, perched on high cliffs over the main routes into the rich Shenandoah Valley, including the slave driver route to Kentucky. Brown and his men quickly seized the town's federal armory, which held a massive cache of arms. He sent detachments to nearby plantations to try to recruit rebels willing to rise up against slavery, and also cut telegraph lines and stopped the eastbound evening train. The attack went wrong from the start. Brown's men killed a train conductor, ironically a free African American, and then inexplicably let the train continue down the tracks to Washington, bringing news of the raid. Brown's recruiting parties brought only 4 people back from nearby slave quarters. The next morning, local militia forced their way into town, shooting one of Brown's men, an ex-slave named Dangerfield Newby. As he fell, Newby clutched at the despairing letters in his pocket. They came from his wife, Harriet, who was enslaved with their children in Northern Virginia. Her last one had been written on August 16. "It is said Master is in want of money. If so, I know not what time he may sell me, and then all my bright hopes of the future are blasted." The price of slaves at the Richmond consignment market had risen above $1,000 for women like Harriet, and her owner had changed his mind about letting Newby buy her freedom. Now some militiamen paused to mutilate Newby's corpse, cutting off his testicles and his ears as souvenirs. The rest forced Brown and his remaining men to make their stand in the armory. The next morning, U.S. Marines from Washington, under an Army colonel named Robert E. Lee, stormed the stronghold. The Federals killed many raiders, including 2 of Brown's sons, and captured the badly wounded Brown. Though Brown's crimes were clearly federal, Buchanan allowed the state of Virginia to try him. The trial was a procedural travesty, but there was no lack of evidence for his conviction for inciting insurrection. Before his sentencing, Brown was allowed to speak. The New Testament, on which he had sworn to tell the whole truth, he noted, commanded him to remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. As if he were bound himself, he had taken up arms to defend slaves' rights to freedom. If his sacrifice brought justice closer, then he would gladly now mingle my blood further with the blood of my children and with the blood of millions in this slave country whose rights are disregarded by wicked, cruel, and unjust enactments. On December 2, 1859, with hundreds of militia guarding the execution site at Charlestown against a rescue attempt that never came, the state of Virginia hanged John Brown. Brown's wife recovered his corpse and sent it to their farm in New York for burial. The bodies of the two African Americans executed with him, South Carolina fugitives Shields Green and Freeman John Copeland, were taken by medical students and used as dissection cadavers. For 70 years, Southern and Northern economic and political elites, and many average white citizens, had cooperated to extract profit and power from the forced movement and exploitation of enslaved people's bodies and minds. Always, the pro-slavery forces had made the rest of the United States choose between profitable expansion of the slave country or economic slowdown, between slavery and disunion, between supporting a party turned into a colonized host for viral pro-slavery dogma or defeat in national elections, between bills for expanding slavery into Kansas, or passing up the opportunity to build a transcontinental railroad. John Brown and his band of futile revolutionaries signaled that the game was changing. The clarity of Lincoln's arguments had also raised the warning, but he had at least lost in 1858, and perhaps Northerners would once more flinch from containing the expansion of slavery in 1860. But somehow, in losing, Dangerfield Newby, Shields Green, John Copeland, and John Brown had won. For now, Southerners believed they had to choose: run the risks created by making good on the threat to leave the Union, or remain in the Union and risk another Harper's Ferry. Someone discovered a map at Brown's Maryland hideout. Newspapers breathlessly detailed the additional targets marked on it. Whites began to look at any neighbor of uncertain origin, eyeing them as potential John Browns, seeing every newspaper report of a local murder as part of a wider plot. William Keat, Florida slave owner and brother of secessionist politician Lawrence Keat, had his throat slit in the middle of the night by his own slaves. A traveler from South Carolina was seized in deepest Alabama by a local mob, although eventually, when he proved that he owned slaves back home, they let him go. A Massachusetts mapmaker, peddling his wares in Georgia, was picked up by vigilance committees. An Irishman in Columbia, South Carolina, dared to express the opinion that slavery drove down wage rates for white laborers. A mob stripped him naked. The state legislatures ordered a slave to beat him, and then they poured boiling tar on his bleeding skin and doused him with feathers. The Northern newspaper that interviewed the Irishman when he made it back to New York reported that he had always voted with the Democratic Party. Rumors of slave conspiracies and news of lynchings competed with each other throughout the anxious winter and spring of 1859 to 1860. And alongside them were stories about Northern whites who heaped hagiographic praise on John Brown as he dangled. National Republican politicians disavowed the raid, but even moderate opponents of slavery expansion adopted Brown as a symbol of uncompromising resistance against much-resented slave lords. The city of Albany, New York, fired 100 salutes to John Brown on December 2, starting at the scheduled time of his execution. Northern middle-class public culture depicted him as Christ-like. Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote that John Brown would make the gallows as glorious as the cross. And Henry David Thoreau, last heard from as a pacifist proponent of nonviolence and a non-tax-paying protester against the Mexican War, said that, for manly directness and force, and for simple truth, all the talk of politicians could not equal the few casual remarks of crazy John Brown. Brown was, Thoreau believed, the first Northern man whom the slaveholder has learned to respect. Certainly, Brown had forced slaveholders to make new calculations. And now the long tide of slavery's expansion across the continent and hegemony over national politics seemed to poise at a crest. Crash or roll on forward? The crop of cotton in 1859 was astonishing. Almost 2 billion pounds of clean fiber in 4 million bales. Slavery's productivity was higher than ever. Some 700 pounds per enslaved man, woman, and child in the cotton country. 22 times the rate in 1790. The old rules of political gravity, the way 4 million slaves multiplied by 3/5 of the vote for each, plus 4 million and climbing bales of cotton, plus the needs of northern politicians to maintain interregional coalitions, had all worked to keep a national minority at the controls of national policy. But as Southern Democrats looked toward the upcoming 1860 National Party Convention, they feared that the failure of Lecompton, the rise of the Republicans, and the possibility of an emerging consensus in the North had seemingly arrested their project of writing entrepreneurial slavery expansion permanently into the rules of the American political system. They had told themselves that their ultimate recourse was the right to secede from the Union. Secession had become a truism of Southern public discourse, and disunion now seemed far more attractive than it had in the 1850 crisis. The boom decade had erased Southerners' fears that their economic system was either weak or decaying. Because cotton is king, as South Carolina's James H. Hammond brayed in 1858 on the floor of the Senate, no power on earth dare make war on cotton. The North would not dare to resist their going, and cotton would allow the South to continue its decade of prosperity indefinitely. Although Mississippi Senators Jefferson Davis and Albert Gallatin Brown introduced Senate resolutions operationalizing Dred Scott by requiring the federal government to impose a slave code on all territories, many politically active Southern citizens had, by early 1860, abandoned the idea of seeking solutions from normal politics. The state legislatures across the South were stocking their militia armories. Some Southern representatives in Washington were plotting a coup. They themselves would seize the Capitol and then would call their home states to send in their militias to defend a provisional government. The South Carolina legislature sent an emissary to Virginia counterparts shaken by Harper's Ferry to discuss a cooperative secession from the Union. The Mississippi legislature called for a Southern convention to be held at Atlanta to consider mass exit from the Union. Florida and Alabama counterparts voted for cooperative secession. In the end, the coup that Southwestern Democrats led was against their own party. Luck, or doom, had scheduled Charleston, South Carolina, as the site of the Democratic Party's April 1860 National Convention. There, the heirs of 60 years of entrepreneurship on the cotton and sugar frontiers planned to force the party to bow before them and commit to making slavery's endless expansion a matter of national policy. Or else, as the Alabama State Party had instructed its delegates, secede from the convention, what South Carolina's Robert Barnwell Rhett called demolition of the party. The Southerners opened the convention by insisting that the National Party's platform had to incorporate the federal slave code that Brown and Davis had proposed in the U.S. Senate. The Northern delegates, a majority in the convention hall, refused. Take a slave code platform before the free state electorate, they warned, and when the dust settled, there would be left of the Democratic Party of the North scarcely one candidate to tell that there were Democrats living there. You are telling us, said a delegate from Ohio, that we are an inferior class of beings, that we shall not assume to have or express any opinions, but only serve the Southerners' interests. Gentlemen, he said, you mistake us. We will not do it. The delegations of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, South Carolina, Florida, Arkansas, and Texas stomped out. The Georgians complained that their cotton-growing counterparts should have left over a different issue, the reopening of the international slave trade, and then they too left. Caleb Cushing, chairing the convention, ruled that a presidential nominee needed 2/3 of the original delegates. It was mathematically impossible for Stephen Douglas, who after successfully defying Buchanan on Lecompton had the virtually united support of Northern Democrats, to get the required number of delegates. The remaining delegates decided to reconvene in Baltimore on June 18. There, the Northern Democrats refused to reseat the Charleston seceders, who decided to meet across the street. Northern delegates in the main convention voiced their anger. Slave owners wanted to rule or ruin. Ruling niggers all their lives, they thought they could rule white men just the same. They nominated Douglas. In the other convention, the secessionist Democrats wrote a pro-slavery everywhere and forever platform. They nominated John Breckinridge, Buchanan's Kentucky vice president. Meanwhile, a group of old Whigs, most of them well over 60, added a third presidential candidate to the mix by naming Tennessee's John Bell to the ticket of their so-called Constitutional Union Party. Many in the border states would vote for Bell as a possible way out of the madness. But the Black Republicans, as the race-baiting Democrats called them, had already nominated their candidate. Meeting in Chicago, the party's chieftains rejected their most prominent national figures, William Seward and Salmon Chase. Although these men were popular among loyalists in party strongholds, in Pennsylvania and the Northwest, they were viewed as radical abolitionists. The Republicans needed an electoral vote majority, so the party turned to Abraham Lincoln. He could appear to lower North voters as a moderate who didn't exude the moral triumphalism that clung to Chase and Seward. Yet he could also maintain the Republican case against further compromise. In 1858, against Douglas and in a widely reprinted speech at New York's Cooper Institute in early 1860, Lincoln had argued that ending expansion would kill off slavery over the course of the next century. This solution and time frame meant that white voters did not have to wrap their minds around an immediate transformation of racial hierarchies. Lincoln's nomination may have decided the outcome of the election of 1860. The South was going to split its votes between Breckinridge and Bell. The Republicans counted on New England, Ohio, Illinois, and the far Northwest. If they also won New York and Pennsylvania, they'd have the presidency. The party organized clubs of wide awakes, young male Lincoln supporters who made it their business to rumpus and campaign wherever the fight is hottest, as the Hartford, Connecticut club put it. State party bosses such as Simon Cameron of Pennsylvania and Thurlow Weed of New York also unleashed their grimy turnout mechanisms. On November 6, Lincoln carried every free state except New Jersey. In a four-way contest, he won 40% of the popular vote, collecting 180 of the 303 electoral votes. Despite Democrats' claims that Republican victory would mean both the end of slavery and the handing over of white women to black men, Breckinridge had not won the Upper South. Some Union sentiment survived there. Without those states and their large white populations, an independent South would be smaller, its army far weaker. Now that the national electorate had chosen a black Republican president, would the Cotton States now back down from their politicians' threats to secede from the Union? If they did secede, would their white citizens really resort to arms if the federal government moved, like Jackson in the nullification winter of 1832 to 1833, to coerce the states? In late October, South Carolina Governor William Gist had written his fellow slave state executives to ask if they were prepared to call secession conventions if Lincoln won. The Republicans frankly stated that they intended to block the expansion of slavery, with the goal of bringing about the ultimate extinction of slavery. Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and Florida all replied affirmatively, but hoped South Carolina would take the lead. Now, on November 10, the South Carolina state legislature set an early December date for a state convention of delegates to consider secession. The other cotton states did the same. The South Carolina election was held, the convention met, and on December 20, delegates voted unanimously for secession. Within 3 weeks, conventions in Mississippi and Florida also voted for secession. Alabama, Georgia, and Louisiana followed, and then, on February 1, 1861, Texas also seceded. Perhaps the majority of whites in the cotton states really felt the same imperatives as the entrepreneurs who were threatened by the closing off of expansion, and perhaps they did not. But political leaders manipulated convention elections to make sure they would yield the desired result. The options offered to voters were limited to one pathway to secession or another, either immediate or cooperative. The latter meaning they preferred to wait for other states to secede first. Even those choosing cooperationist secession were derided as submissionists, willing to truckle under to Yankee tyranny. Convention delegates were also significantly wealthier than the overall white population. The median Mississippi delegate owned 15 slaves, the Alabama delegate 13, the Georgians 14, and the South Carolinians 37. Slaveholder cooperationists elected from non-planter districts often went to state capitals under instruction from their constituents: slow down secession. Yet once they were surrounded by their economic peers, they changed their positions and gave their conventions near-unanimous outcomes. Still, even if the enslavers who dominated the conventions rigged the process of secession in order to defend the pro-slavery state they were creating, they ultimately had to appeal to the yeomen and poor whites whose doubts, and in some cases commitment to the Union, they had procedurally suppressed. Ever since the end of the Civil War, Confederate apologists have put out the lie that the Southern states seceded and Southerners fought to defend an abstract constitutional principle of states' rights. That falsehood attempts to sanitize the past. Every convention's participants made it explicit. They were seceding because they thought secession would protect the future of slavery. Lincoln's victory led Deep South slaveholders to claim that only secession could save the South from being stripped, as one Alabama editor, a former Douglas supporter, said, of 2,500 millions of slave property, and to have loose among us 4 million of freed blacks. From Missouri to Texas, from Wilmot through Kansas, Nebraska, and Lecompton, political debates had been about whether or not slavery could expand, not whether or not the federal government would interfere with it in the states where it existed. But secessionists feared that they could not convince the non-slave-holding white Southern majority to abandon the Union just to protect entrepreneurs' access to future cotton frontiers. Instead, they proclaimed that by electing Republicans, the North had declared its commitment to equality between the white and Negro races, as an emissary sent from the Mississippi Convention told his Georgia counterparts. Not only had the Republican Party declared its goal to be abolition, but it now demands equality in the right of suffrage, equality in the honors and emoluments of office, equality in the social circle, equality in the right of matrimony. Not only would emancipation mean that non-planters would lose the chance to move up in the world, a chance that ownership of even one slave could represent. Worse, the everyday distinctions that gave status to all whites, especially men, would vanish. Lincoln's victory left only one choice: secede, or your neighbor's field hand will marry your daughter. Secede, or offer up your wives and daughters to pollution and violation to gratify the lust of half-civilized Africans. Republican domination, the emissary concluded, meant a saturnalia of blood, a war of extermination that would lead to the destruction of the white people by assassinations and amalgamation or rape. If racial fears led non-slaveholders to accept the pro-slavery argument, enslavers could continue to plan for slavery to resume its modernist, capitalist, entrepreneurial, creative, destructive, right-hand empowering course of expansion. They could continue to deploy the apparatus of forced migration and slave trading that commodified black bodies, rhetorically breaking them into pieces for more profitable use by white people and creating isolated and rapable black women. Yet the rhetoric of fear makes one wonder if the speakers knew that common white men feared the South's volatile, highly unequal, extractive, exploitative economy, and knew that without the safety net of racial privilege, and slavery was that net's strongest cord, they would fall into complete poverty and degradation. Perhaps, too, the speakers' horrors projected their own scrambled-together desires and anxieties about life in a migratory, expanding modern economy where fortunes were made and lost at a drop, the conflation of sexual force and political power, and the mixing of sexual pleasure with the use of enslaved bodies for making wealth. While these arguments worked well enough in the seven cotton-focused states, non-slaveholder majorities in Upper South states stomped on the brakes. The February 4 election for a Virginia state convention produced only 32 immediate secessionists out of 153 total delegates. Despite the commitment of James Mason and others to Calhounite ideology, less wealthy, less ideologically committed citizens of the Old Dominion were not ready. In the same month, the voters of Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri, and North Carolina also rejected secession, at least for the time being. Meanwhile, in Washington, senators and representatives scrambled to resurrect interregional compromise at the federal level. Kentucky's John Crittenden put together a committee of 13 senators whose task was finding a way out of the crisis. In the tradition of Henry Clay, Crittenden offered an omnibus of 6 constitutional amendments and 4 resolutions. Most significant was the amendment that would restore the Missouri Compromise line and commit the federal government to enforcing slavery south of 36 degrees 30 minutes north forever. Another would have forbidden any future change to these amendments, the 3/5 clause or the fugitive slave clause of the Constitution. If adopted by Congress, and 3/4 of the state legislatures would also have had to approve them to add them to the Constitution, Crittenden's proposals would have made slavery perpetual in the United States. They would have added new enticements to filibustering. Here was the pattern of compromise reasserted, a placating response to Southern brinkmanship. The passage of these amendments might not have persuaded the cotton states to reverse their charge toward political independence. The white population of those 7 states was now swept up in a level of violent political fervor that made it hard for anyone to suggest a change in course. A commitment to the idea that Southerners constituted a separate political community was already becoming its own justification. In the meantime, Southern political leaders still in Washington over December 1860 and January 1861, such as Mississippi's Jefferson Davis, remained cool toward the various plans for compromise. While many Republican Party leaders anxiously participated in the compromise negotiations, the president-elect took a different position. To Thurlow Weed, master of the New York Republican machine, Lincoln wrote, "Let there be no compromise on the question of extending slavery. If there be, all our labor is lost, and ere long must be done again." The people had spoken. They voted for a platform that opposed all expansion of slavery. Lincoln refused to abandon the results of the election. His insistence that the tug has to come and better now stiffened the resolve of congressional Republicans, who decided to reject the 36 degrees, 30 minutes extension, though they did offer to admit New Mexico as a slave state. Some historians have criticized Lincoln for these moves. He and other Northerners allegedly misread the South, believing that secessionists were only bullies playing a game of chicken to force the North to back down again. The result of the failure to compromise, this line of thinking argues, was mass death. Such critics of Lincoln's interference with compromise bolster their claims with cost-benefit analyses that assume that slavery would have ended in a few decades even without war. Thus, the primary positive gain of the war is accounted as 30 years of freedom for several million people, versus, in the loss column, the deaths of about 700,000 Americans, plus the massive financial cost of the war. Yet the assumption that slavery would have ended is based on the idea that it was an inefficient form of labor that would soon be weeded out by economic realities. By 1860, this system had been growing for 70 years at a rate unprecedented in human history. It had broken its supposed limits again and again. Moreover, in practical terms, the Crittenden plan itself would have rendered the end of slavery far more difficult to accomplish. And, as Lincoln wrote in January, "Adopt Crittenden, and the past tells us that a year will not pass till we shall have to take Cuba as a condition upon which they will stay in the Union." In any case, the seceding states sent no emissaries to Washington or Springfield that winter, offered no bargains that included renunciation of disunion. On March 4, Lincoln stood before a crowd in Washington to take the same oath that Andrew Jackson had taken. 32 years later, the democracy that Jackson's crowd drank in had dissolved. Since late January, armed men had seized most of the federal institutions in the Lower South. Representatives of the 7 cotton states had met in Montgomery, Alabama, and declared themselves the Confederate States of America. They named Mississippi Senator Jefferson Davis as their president. Striking a most un-Jacksonian pose, outgoing President James Buchanan had done nothing about any of this. And by Inauguration Day, a crisis was sharpening to a sword point. Federal troops evacuated their fort near Charleston Harbor's old slave trade wharf and moved to Fort Sumter, a new installation that was much farther offshore. Confederate officials demanded Sumter surrender. So far, its commandant, Colonel Robert Anderson, had refused, but his troops were running out of food. The raw-boned Kentucky-born lawyer took the oath of office from emaciated old Roger Taney. Lincoln then turned to face the crowd. His 6'4" frame towered over the podium. This president, a lifelong opponent of Jackson and his followers, was taking office as the most common man to hold the office, before or since. No president had been poor in his youth. Yet here was Lincoln. And here, too, was another irony. The president-elect had made Jackson's great enemy, Henry Clay, his beau ideal of a statesman. But Lincoln had been studying Andrew Jackson's words from the 1832 to 1833 nullification crisis in preparation for facing down the rebellious enslavers. Just as he had pointed out to his wavering Republican colleagues when he refused surrender disguised as compromise, Lincoln now told the nation and the world that consent to secession meant agreement to the principle that the loser can overrule the outcome of an election. The secessionists' demand, Lincoln argued, ripped the fabric of democratic government, replacing it with the principle that a slaveholder's threat is the ultimate right-handed veto. The claim that states that were controlled by slavery entrepreneurs could break up the United States by unilaterally revoking the contract of the Constitution was analogous to scrawling a GTT on every key document of the Union. At the same time, Lincoln warned, the certain ills you fly to are greater than all the real ones you fly from. If enslavers wanted to protect their property and power, their own decisions were counterproductive. In the War of 1812, thousands of slaves had fled to the British. An army raised in the free states, on the ground in the slave ones, would by its mere presence disrupt enslavers' power. It is certainly strange that few enslaver politicians considered this possibility. Among the few exceptions to this self-induced blindness were ex-Whig megaplanters such as Stephen Duncan and Paul Cameron, who remained unionists deep into the crisis. But in general, the more enslaved people secession delegates owned, the more radical were their demands. In the face of a clear decision between slaveholders and the non-slaveholding whites who appeared to support them, Lincoln counseled patience. He insisted that the Union remained unbroken, but that he would not use his executive power as president to retake seized federal property, send troops into the states, or appoint office holders obnoxious to local communities. Here he accepted the limits of the then possible. In March 1861, the U.S. Army numbered in the few tens of thousands. Moreover, the upper South states remained on the fence. Let Lincoln seem to coerce, and he would shift leverage into the hands of secessionists in those wavering states. So the new president deftly played the ball back into the enslaver's court. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. Perhaps nationalist loyalty and reason would persuade states like Virginia, North Carolina, Missouri, and Kentucky not to join the ranks of secession. So he closed with his famous invocation of the emotional ties of a common history. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic chords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave, will yet swell the chorus of union, when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. The paths of the future were at that moment unlighted. It seemed unlikely that enslavers would accept the new normal that Lincoln offered and remain part of a nation that had decided to insist that they accept that their desires and dreams would shrink rather than expand. Their inevitable rejection meant that suddenly the future of millions of enslaved African Americans and of their enslavers, those twinned bodies who spread across a subcontinent in a vast embrace of suffering and power, was more uncertain than it had been since the moment when Andrew Jackson looked out across the sugarcane stubble and January mire at Pakenham's scarlet lines. Or then again, as open as at any one of the millions of moments when enslaved men and women pushed their minds and nerves and hands to pick one or two more pounds before twilight fell, to save their backs from the cowhide verdicts of slate and chalk. In those moments, entrepreneurs had revolutionized the world. They had always done so. This time, instead of trying to sweep away old market patterns, traditional ways of making things, or African Americans' families, it was the union that they would try to sweep aside. And then, as with all of those other creations and destructions, they would try to replace it with a new arrangement that was far more conducive to their own profit and power. Back when John Brown's attack began to make the possibility of a resort to arms seem less like a distant fantasy, Henry David Thoreau had written these prophetic words about the imminent execution of the martyr. "When you plant a hero in his field, a crop of heroes is sure to spring up." Still, the White South did not believe the North would fight. Lincoln's caution seemed unheroic. Perhaps it fed the Confederate leader's confidence about war as a solution. But in the month after the inauguration, the new president demonstrated that he was canny enough to outmaneuver enslavers on the field of peace. Instead of forcing his way into Charleston's harbor with blazing guns, he sent a resupply fleet sailing from New York with instructions to resupply the Fort Sumter garrison, but not to reinforce it with troops and weapons. The South's decision makers decided to move the game onto a different board. They would assert their independence by eliminating the Union presence off the coast of the state where the cotton frontier had started. On April 10, the local Confederate commander heard from Montgomery, "Tell the Union troops to evacuate Fort Sumter immediately. If they refuse, begin the bombardment before supplies can arrive." At 4:30 a.m. on April 12, the first cannon boomed. Fort Sumter surrendered at first light on the 14th, after 33 hours of shelling that produced not a single fatality. Afterward, the corpse, 1861 to 1937. Liza McCallum walked slowly back from the lawyer's office. Just a few days had passed since her second husband, Cade, had died. Now he lay in a whitewashed, above-ground New Orleans tomb. The February wind, cold for Louisiana, bit her 73-year-old bones. It blew a freak flurry across the city of the dead, sweeping stray flakes like tiny sheets of paper over the whitewashed wall and toward Liza's slow walk along nearby Oak Street. She was probably thinking about the cold mechanics of how to keep living. Since 1890, Cade had been receiving a pension from the federal government as a former soldier of the Union Army. To get it transferred to her, she had to prove that they had been legally married. So now the lawyer would mail her deposition to Washington, where bureaucrats would judge it. A clerk would eventually file the document with all the other paper that made up the McCallum case. Then he would put Bundle 11, Can 53367, back in its place between 53366 and 53368 on the shelf, in a warehouse full of shelves. On those shelves still sleep the biographies of a million men who had defended the nation against those who fought for the slaveholders' right to expand slavery. The bundles and cans also contain the story of soldiers' families, friends, fellow soldiers, and communities. And yet they hold clouds of silence, too, fogs that seep from their pages and weigh on the dark air between and under the shelves. For instance, Liza's own life story, which she told in the depositions she gave to support her claim to Cade's pension, also revealed that she simply couldn't know all of Cade's biography. Cade McCallum, Liza told the lawyer, had been born somewhere near the Atlantic. An army friend, who also submitted to an interview for the pension's claim, had once said Cade was born in North Carolina. But all Liza remembered was stories about catching fish from a boat. Maybe he had told her Maryland. Like each of the millions of individuals whose biographies together compose the great epic of the expansion of slavery's body, he could have explained to Liza how forced migration had destroyed the life into which he'd been born. He could have told her that story every night for decades. But when they both closed their eyes to sleep, no one but Cade, to borrow the words of another survivor of enslavement, could truly guess the awfulness of it for him in his own life. Perhaps half of every story is forever unheard. Yet Liza knew some essential facts. She knew that in 1850, when Cade was already a grown man, his enslaver sent him to Richmond. Turned into money, shipped onto New Orleans, and sold as a hand, by 1861, Cade was toiling on the Iberville Parish slave labor camp of a woman whom he remembered as Madame Palang. Liza, for her own part, was in 1861 the property and chief capital investment of a Boonville, Missouri storekeeper. When news of Fort Sumter came, the Missouri state government immediately split in two halves, pro-Union and pro-Confederate. When the Union Army gained control over the area around St. Louis, anti-slavery writers and the Northern press pushed President Lincoln to use war powers for emancipation. Lincoln refused, announcing, "I hope to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky," and countermanding Union General John Fremont's preemptive assertion of emancipation in Missouri, like Kentucky, a border state. But Liza's enslaver already saw how, just as at Fortress Monroe in Virginia, the presence of Union troops at St. Louis could tempt enslaved African Americans to escape. Hearing that a man named Daniel Berger was buying up slaves to take them south, he cashed Liza out for U.S. dollars. By the late summer of 1861, she was in the trader's yard in the town of Plaquemine, coincidentally in Iberville Parish. By that time, Cade McCollum was still on Palang's farm, though he was probably no longer picking cotton. In 1861 and 1862, Southern cotton producers, believing that their collective monopoly on the international cotton market gave them leverage that would sway European powers to their side if they induced a cotton famine, quit planting and selling their great staple. Most grew food crops for Confederate armies instead. By early 1862, the number of bales received at Liverpool fell to 3% of the 1860 level. The sudden dearth of cotton on the world market raised prices, ironically rendering cotton from other production zones price competitive with the yield of enslaved hands for the first time in the 19th century. In West Africa and in Brazil, cotton production expanded dramatically. And in Egypt, farmers turned the rich soil of the Nile Delta into a huge cotton plantation. They took their earnings from 1861 to Cairo and purchased slaves brought down the Nile from Sudan or across the desert in caravans from Darfur. One historian estimates that the slave trade to Egypt expanded from less than 5,000 per year in the 1850s to more than 20,000 by 1865. Even before the end of 1861, the Confederacy lost control of its oldest cotton region, South Carolina's Sea Islands. When Union ships bearing an invasion force arrived off the coast south of Charleston in the summer of 1861, enslavers fled. Union forces occupied the coast around Hilton Head. African Americans, who made up over 90% of the local population, began talking about dividing the plantations where they had toiled for generations into individual farms. But federal and other northern policymakers feared that the South would follow the Jamaican precedent. There, after Britain's 1834 empire-wide emancipation, formerly enslaved people refused to participate in sugar plantation labor, wrecking Jamaica's commodity export economy. To prevent a repetition of that process, as the 1862 crop season loomed, the Treasury Department claimed authority over the abandoned lands and rented them to northern entrepreneurs who proposed to reorganize and revive cotton production on the Sea Islands. Often, the lessees' agenda went beyond profit alone. For example, there was the group of Vermont entrepreneurs who assured the Treasury that their New England skill and energy could direct these persons to grow cotton 25% cheaper when employed by fair wages than when compelled to do it as slaves. Thus, they could prove that enslavers not only were politically imperialistic, destroying the rights of other white people, but also had operated an inefficient, backward system. Indeed, they believed, so favorable an opportunity to prove this will probably not occur again for ages. Should $6 per month prove insufficient motivation to convince newly liberated African Americans to enter the cotton wage labor market, instead of growing corn and yams to eat, The New Englanders also asked permission to use the ball and chain to enforce authority. The experiment didn't work, at least not on the terms of northern plantation lessees. They signed contracts to pay workers by the month, only to find that at the end of 1862, half of the cotton was rotting in the fields, cotton that could have been picked only at whip-driven speed. Unwilling to admit that wage labor might not be as efficient in all cases as slave, some experimented with paying pickers by the pound, withholding monthly wages until the end of the harvest, or haranguing the workers, telling them that if they fail to work well, I shall report them to Massa Lincoln as too lazy to be free. Yet neither Sea Island experiments nor distant continents came close to spinning Lancashire's mills back up to speed. Cotton remained scarce on the world market, and cotton prices sky high. Across this particular continent, the Union and the Confederacy fought bigger and bloodier battles with almost every passing month. By late 1862, the two warring republics, one slave and the other still part slave, had between them almost 1 million men under arms. The Union barely blunted a southern invasion in a battle where 3,600 soldiers died and 17,000 were wounded on a single September day at Antietam Creek in western Maryland. Most of the press focused on the eastern theater of war. Much of the nation's historical memory continues to focus on the drama and the generals of that front of battle. Yet the war was also decided on the cotton frontier of the Mississippi Valley, the theater where many of the fundamental dramas of American economic development had played out. And the key event here occurred on the end of April 1862, when a Union fleet, succeeding where the British had failed, broke through the Mississippi River's collar of forts and reached New Orleans. Confederate officials fled the South's biggest city, and Union troops disembarked on the same levee where Rachel and so many others had landed. Soon after the Union captured New Orleans, contrabands began to leave nearby slave labor camps and stream into the Army's Camp Parapet, just west of the city. Parapet's Union commandant resisted enslavers' entreaties for him to sort out the bond people of loyal masters and send them back. So many thousands of runaways thronged the facility that the Army soon built a second camp in St. Charles Parish at Bonny Coree, not far from the 1811 slave revolt's epicenter.
Context of white supremacy. That is where we will pick up at going into the second audio second. Again, that will wrap up the book. We are, looks like, 39 pages from being all done. If you have commentary you would like to share, feel free. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to call in, but you don't want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It should be linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. When you put in the address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link for the free VOPE line. Click it. It will open a tiny window on your screen. The first line in that new window, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. The final line, it will ask for a name. You can use your real name. You can use a nickname. Press random keys if you like. Once you get all that entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program, and you should be able to hear us live. Same procedure if you'd like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do so, I'll see you on the switchboard, and we will get you on the line. Again, we are wrapping this book up today, so if you have concluding comments, major themes that you'll take away from the book, if there are things, themes or what have you that you see that have been prevalent throughout the text as we've been reading it, feel free to chime in, but we have one more audio session, and we will be all done. Edward Baptist, the half has never been told. Let's see, Mr. Demery 4, Roz, you all are both with us. I will add other callers as I see them. Both of your lines should be open. Feel free to comment.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. And Gus, if I become distorted, if you let me know before too long, then I'll make some adjustments to the phone. It may be this headset. But the key word is final on this program. You know, I have learned a lot from the book, but it may be time to put it to bed. The book is told through slave narratives, plantation records, newspapers, words of leading politicians and entrepreneurs and former slaves and slave owners. It's also written in a way what I consider to be cultural appropriation of Ralph Ellison's depiction of the black body, whereas this author used body parts to name the chapters, the head, feet, hands, tongue, arms, backs, and the corpse. And it exemplifies how whites took everything from a group of people, blacks, and to some parts, to some extent, even their sanity. I thought it was interesting that the book brought out that John Brown, you know, contrary to what a lot of people believe, that he was crazy and had some wild scheme, that he had met with the so-called Secret Six, and they were financing his endeavors. The abolitionists, Jared Smith, Theodore Parker. The book also emphasized the fears cropping up, white people, fears of Nat Turner and maybe some more crazed Negroes. And so that sort of turned the atmosphere. And then when they finally caught John Brown, you know, his widow confiscated his body, and he was buried on their farm, but they mutilated Newby's corpse, cutting off his testicles and his ears, souvenirs, typical white racist behavior. And Shields Green and John Copeland's body was taken by medical students and used as dissection cadavers. The book brought out the fact that enslavers overused their leverage, so they may have been their own worst enemies, but they were doing everything possible to keep slavery expanding and to keep blacks under this slave system. There was offers to reimburse slave owners for emancipated slaves, but no compensation was ever offered or given to any of the ex-slaves, who often ended up in union-controlled labor camps. I'll speak some on that a little later, but I just wanted to mention the USCT, the United States Colored Troops, you know, blacks that served in the military, the pensions to the widows. You can imagine what they had to go through. And then to get those survivor benefits, proving marriage and also birth certificates or anything of that nature, probably was a nightmare. And the fact that a lot of slaves, ex-slaves, didn't know where or when they were born. And the book mentioned that ex-slaves were considered contraband. Therefore, the Union soldiers was not obligated to return them back to the slave owners as their property. So I'll mute my line and give somebody else a chance. I got a few more notes that I give in the next reading. Thanks, Gus.
For sure, for sure. Thomas in New York and Raj should be with us. If you all have commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and all the listeners as well. Yeah, I agree with Mr. Demery that it's about time we close it out. What I've taken away overall from the book is that essentially what the entire system of racism, white supremacy was designed to do was to basically reinvent non-white people and make them basically the mirror of white projection, because everything that they say about non-white people are exactly what white people are. And what they've effectively done is created a system that would retard non-white people to the level that we would be as low and then pushed lower than they originally were and still are. It's just that they have this false projection of regal royal whiteness that they put out there, but they're just savages. And what they've done is reduced people who were once civilized to savages and then blame them for their own savagery. That's basically what I take away overall from the book. But I found a few things quite fascinating. There was a part on page 381 that said Free Staters boycotted the ratification ballot, as well, and the pro-slavery voters who participated approved the Lecompton Constitution by a tally of 6,000 to 600. As Northerners watched this travesty unfold each day on the pages of their telegraph updated newspapers, Southern Democrats pressed for instant congressional acceptance of the undemocratic document, which would be the last step in confirming Kansas as a slave state. I found this to be a very deliberate act of racism, simply because he's calling their voting for slavery a travesty, which really it wasn't, because they were fighting for whether the North's form of racism, white supremacy, would be dominant or the South's form of racism, white supremacy would be dominant. And when he also calls this an undemocratic document, it's very democratic, because everything that this nation has done to black people and to non-white people in general has always been done with government sanction. Throughout this entire book, we've read about how the government was behind all kinds of terroristic acts. So to me, this is just double speak again, or rhetorical ethics that the author is using in that section. Then further down the same page, it says, still, while other Southern nationalists savored Schadenfreude. And I looked that up, and it's Schadenfreude means to derive pleasure from hearing or seeing the misery of others. I found that to be an act of racism as well, because white people, whether Northern or Southern, they all derive severe gratification from the abuse, mistreatment, and genocide against black people. And I just find it very much an act of racism that he would try to separate the North from the South, which has always been a big misconception, especially for black people. We've been under the impression that the North was somehow better than the South. But I go with what Minister Malcolm said: as long as you're south of the Canadian border, you are down south. And one of the other things I wanted to talk about. On the bottom of page 382, it says, Lincoln acknowledged that most Northern whites were reluctant to imagine a society in which African Americans could claim the rights of the free, much less the rights of the equal. So essentially what he's saying again is that northern whites are definitely no different from their southern white counterparts. They just had different ideas about how to practice racism, white supremacy, and ultimately the North were the ones who basically wanted the dominance at that particular time. But they never thought that we were equal, which he was one of them as well. And they did not think or did not want us to claim the rights of the free, as he says, out of his own mouth. I found on 384, they had a whole paragraph dedicated to John Brown, and they described him in such glowing terms. They said, the backers changed vicariously, righteously. Here was a northerner truly willing to meet southern bullying with unblinking violence. They agreed to send Brown money and weapons, and he established a hideout near Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. From there, he began recruiting commandos, and so on and so forth. And I just find this, again, just another act of racism. They're trying to make him the John Wayne of anti-racist. The only thing I could say that might be considered good about him, because he's a racist too, is that he was willing to kill other white people. Any white person that's willing to kill other white people, I'm good with that. But outside of that, he gets no props from me. And I just see the writer perpetuating this false myth of John Brown being the gun-toting Tim Wise. Also, just I won't speak too much on it, but Mr. Demery brought up the cutting off of Mr. Newby's testicles, and I just thought of that. Essentially, they were treating him like a black person, and that's how I looked at that. And then, of course, the mutilation of the two African Americans that were executed with John Brown, and the use of their bodies as dissection cadavers. And it just speaks to the complete and utter disrespect of black bodies. And it made me think of a documentary I saw on the, I believe it was National Geographic, where they were talking about how white scientists discovered the pineal gland. And it was from essentially taking black soldiers. They took a bunch of black soldiers, and they also did dissections on white soldiers' brains. And there was, like, I think hundreds of them, if I'm not mistaken, from the documentary. And that's where they first discovered what the pineal gland was, the fact that that white people had calcified pineal glands versus black people who had functional pineal glands. All of this was discovered in this documentary. They talk about basically taking corpses. I think it might have been from the Vietnam War, the Korean War, and they would just dissect them without anyone's permission. So, again, just the disrespect of black bodies, and that's what that made me think about. Also, I found this very interesting. At the bottom of page 385, it says, John Brown and his band of feudal revolutionaries signaled that the game was changing. And I found that to be a coded message to white people. The term feudal revolutionaries basically is saying that any whites joining with blacks are feudal in any fight against racism, white supremacy. So I think that that was kind of like a subliminal warning to any white person reading the book that might be thinking on the level of doing what Dr. Wilson said white people should be doing, which is be willing to take up arms against those white people who are practicing racism, is basically giving them a message, don't even think about it, because you're going to get it if you do. And then on the following page, they had a section where they talk about an Irishman, and the Irishman basically says, an Irishman in Columbia, South Carolina, dared to express the opinion that slavery drove down wages for white laborers. A mob stripped him naked. State legislators ordered a slave to beat him. Then they poured boiling tar on his bleeding skin and doused him with feathers. A northern news. Oh, yeah. So I just want to get to that part. Again, back then, it seems like Irish people were not treated as honorary whites at that time. And as a result, he got the nigger treatment again, tarred and feathered. And to add insult to injury, before they tar and feather him, they have a black person beat him. So to me, that was just very symbolic of what Irish people were treated like. And, you know, lo and behold, today, quite a few of white people who were police officers and paddy rollers during the slave days were Irishmen. So I found that very fascinating as well. Oh, here, this is something that made me think about the author. It says on page 390, ever since the end of the Civil War, Confederate apologists have put out the lie that the Southern states seceded and Southerners fought to defend an abstract constitutional principle of states' rights. That falsehood attempts to sanitize the past. Every convention's participants made it explicit they were seceding because they thought secession would protect the future of slavery. I just thought that he, as a white male, put out a very strong secret, a historical secret, because that's exactly what I learned in school. And I just wondered how white people have reacted to him and treated him as a result of revealing a secret of that type. On the following page, 391, there's a brief section that says, secede or your neighbor's field hand will marry your daughter. Secede or offer up your wives and daughters to pollution and violation to gratify the lust of half-civilized Africans. Republican domination, the emissary concluded, meant a saturnalia of blood, a war of extermination that would lead to the destruction of white people by assassinations and amalgamation or rape. And this was a Wilson moment, Dr. Wilson moment right there. It just speaks to the fear of white genetic annihilation and the whole concept of white people's fear that black people will turn their treatment of us on them. And I just found that to be very fascinating, and pretty much they made it plain. Also, on the following paragraph, where it reads, if racial fears led non-slaveholders to accept the pro-slavery argument, enslavers could continue to plan for slavery to resume its modernist, capitalist, entrepreneurial, creative, destructive, right-hand, empowering course of expansion. They could continue to deploy the apparatus of forced migration and slave trading that commodified black bodies, rhetorically breaking them into pieces for more profitable use by white people and creating isolated and rapable black women. And this speaks to what you were talking about in the last, I believe, two sessions, where you speak to the American slave coast and the systematic rape of black women. It's a very covert reference to that, but it really speaks to the fact that the rape of black bodies was a fundamental part of the thread in the fabric of how racism, white supremacy was practiced on black people during that time. And then here on this section, it says, though this is on page 394. It says, though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. This is what Lincoln was saying when he was speaking to the people who, the Southerners, who were wanted to perpetuate slavery when he was trying to get it stopped. And I just felt that that one line in his discussion really speaks to the fact that Lincoln was saying, let not the disagreements on whose method of racism, white supremacy would be dominant, not to let that be the thing that disunites whites who all basically want the same thing, which is racism, white supremacy. So he's basically trying to get them to go along with his aspect of racism, white supremacy, and he's kind of giving them that coded language about, hey, we have to unify under the abuse and domination of black people. So Lincoln was very cunning, very shrewd. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was not a savior. He was a savage just like all of the rest of them. And it's just a shame that so many black people don't really know who he really is. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you for taking my call.
For sure. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
No, I know he wasn't saying Lincoln was a bad guy. He was the guy who freed the slaves. My gosh. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to you, Mr. Demery. You lost. Did they say Lincoln was black? Did I hear that, or was I bugging, Gus?
They called him a black Republican. That was a direct black quote that some of the white enslavers called him. And I think they used that term to reference other white people that they felt were not in agreement with how they wanted to treat the Negroes, black Republican.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, because I had saw a clipping before, and it had Abraham Lincoln Africanus. Abraham Africanus. Have you ever saw that, where they had him looking like a black man, sort of, like a monkey-ish, but with monkey features? Like how they did Obama when he first became president. But I just thought it was very interesting. Unlike the other guys, man, I like this book, man. This book is very informative. I don't want it to end. I want to hear some more about what these teachers have done and how they set up their system. However, you know, I think Mr. Demery hit on it. We'll never know the truth because they wrote it, you know, it's their revision of whatever, you know, it's all their documentation. And unfortunately, not for many of us to read and write, and we're able to document things as well as they were. So it's all coming from kind of their way of thinking. To me, it just seems the Southerners in particular, I would love to ask a true Southerner, white person, if they, knowing what they know now, would go back and have the Civil War again. And I guarantee you they'll probably say, yeah, you just play a little hard because...
Your line is breaking up a little bit. Just a...
To me, it was just so... it was such a stupid war for them to have. I mean, they had all the power. I think they had all the chips in their pocket. You know, they could have just went with a lesser form of slavery. And they'll still be working today. I mean, they just wanted it all. And that greed, that power to have it all, just destroyed them. And how quickly... they had other whites have plan B and C, you know, we're going to have the cotton coming up from here and there. I mean, they were quickly able to conform. You know, they're not planting as much in the southern states, in the United States, our stronghold, no problem. We got these niggas in Brazil. We got the coast of Africa. I mean, they got it right back to popping in a few years. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
For sure. If other folks have comments they want to get in, you should get your hand up. We have about 15 minutes or so before we get to the second and final audio segment for this book. I will throw in next week. I'm leaning towards doing Leonida McLean's Foot in Each World. I talked about that book a lot. That was actually the second highest vote getter last time around. This book was third, and Medical Apartheid was first. I'm trying to break it up so we can do a book that is not so dense. Like, this is, you know, it's a historical book. It's filled with footnotes and reading about stuff that happened 200 years ago, to read something that's a bit more of an easier read and might be a bit more enjoyable and had more votes than this one. I would have to read that one. We did have a black female narrator who said she'd be down to read that book. Unfortunately, she is compiling, I believe, the Medical Apartheid audio, because there's no audiobook for that one either. And I feel a bit greedy asking her to read, because that's such a big book. Medical Apartheid is very similar to this book. I think it might even be a little bit bigger than this book, but it's the same type of thing. It's a history book, lots of references. It's talking about stuff that happened 200, 300 years ago. So it's a dense read. It's something you have to use your brain computer for. I'm trying not to go back to back with two challenging books to force people to really read and pay attention and be looking at the footnotes and all of that, to have a easier book. I was even going to get a novel in there, and then we could do Medical Apartheid. But as I said, I don't feel like asking her to take up all of her time to do two consecutive books. So if there are any black females that would like to redo the narration for A Foot in Each World, let me know. It's kind of short notice in my view, because, I mean, you'd have to have the book by next Friday, and you'd have to have the audio for the first segment complete by next week. So if anybody is down, let me know. If not, I can read it. We have done that before, where it was we had a male author, but the audiobook was narrated by a female. So we have had that before. I don't think it's that big a deal, but it would be cool to have a black female reading a book written, authored by a black female. But I think that's our choice for next week. Anywho, back to this text for this week. LaRon Bennett Jr., Forced into Glory, his biography on Abraham Lincoln. I think folks should definitely read. It's almost on the tip of my tongue to say that is a must read for black people, because there are so many lies that get told about the Civil War and the purpose for it and Abraham Lincoln. And his book specifically is focused on Abraham Lincoln. This guy was a racist. This guy was not some fan of black people. He was not in love with black people and thinking, oh yeah, we got to have the Negroes free. And I'm looking out. I mean, that's just total nonsense. And he goes through and gives different racist jokes that he told, and his stance on slavery, just whatever is expedient. I'm just trying to keep the white team together. I'm not concerned about these Negroes. If we can keep the white team together, keeping slavery, fine, let's do that. If we can keep the white team together and get rid of it, fine. And even if we are going to get rid of it, let's get the Negroes out of here. Send them someplace else, out of the country or what have you. Outstanding text. Black author. I think people that touched on that were so infrequent, where you have an actual black person who is writing, so you get it from their perspective as opposed to the perspective of a race soldier. But LaRon Bennett Jr. and one of our previous guests, Richard Lawrence Miller, he is a well-known, highly regarded Lincoln biographer. He has written like four gargantuan volumes, like you can lift weights with the book about Abraham Lincoln. Same thing. He goes through and has tons of racist jokes that Lincoln told. It was even, I was thinking, very apropos that we had Dixie playing at the beginning of the song, because he talks about how much he loved that song. I think even for America of Flame, a book that we did some years back on the program, White Author, it's also about this period, the Civil War leading up to it, and the massive white terrorism that took place during and after the Civil War. But he also talks about that and gives a lot of great information about Abraham Lincoln, and kind of dismissing some of that just racist nonsense about Lincoln is not a racist, or he's a friend of black people. Anywho, direct commentary from the text where he says, Baptist, that this is right at the beginning of the section for this week. For the millions of people around the globe who hope the modern world would bring liberation from ancient tyrannies, the death of promise of freedom for all in the United States meant the death of the world's hopes for liberation. I just feel like that is, you know, pretty massive act of racism on his part. There are not millions of people around the world who are sad and moaning about the state of enslaved black people in the United States. That is just total nonsense. He has presented no evidence in the book, and I don't think anybody else can either. Slavery is on and popping in Cuba at this time, Brazil. They're still, even though by this point, England has abolished the slave trade. They're not going and stealing black people from the continent directly. They still have got all sorts of pirate slave ships that are on and popping, and all of the English colonies, slavery is still legal and extremely profitable. So, I mean, that's just total nonsense, and it directly contradicts what he says later in the book and what he had said previously when he said that most northern white people that were against the slave power, they hated black people. And he said it again this week, that Abraham Lincoln knew that most white people in the North, they were not fans of black people. So, I mean, that's just absurd to even make a statement like that, that you've got some sort of huge movement of people that are, you know, outraged about this and concerned for the humanity and liberty for Southern Negroes. That is just nonsense, and is racist in my view, because it's inaccurate. That's one of the chief tools of racist man, racist woman, promoting falsehood. Schadenfreude was touched up. I think we've heard that term on the program before, where he says, lots of metaphors this week when he is quoting Lincoln, and Lincoln is using all these metaphors about slavery being a snake in the bed and you better not get it out because you could hit the child and all of that. That another reason that I tell people, like, you should really be on alert when people are using these types of metaphors. When he's saying this, where, you know, slavery is like a snake in the bed and you dare not kill it because you could kill the child, but then if you leave it there, the snake could kill the child, and all of this wrangling back. But to me, this does not sound like someone who is, I am a fan of the Negro. This does not sound like a well-meaning white ally. This sounds like a racist politician who is saying, man, let's just handle the Negro problem the best way that we can so that, you know, we don't do any damage to white people. I'm not really here like, yeah, I'm a champion for Negro rights. I'm just trying to make sure that I don't mess up anything that's going on with whites. Moving forward. Yeah, that's what I said. Lincoln acknowledged that most northern whites were reluctant to imagine a society in which African-Americans could claim the rights of the free, much less the rights of the equal. That huge, like I said, there should be whole books to make that plain, because I think racists, they get a lot of mileage promoting that sort of just racist dogma that you had massive numbers. I mean, the John Brown thing, oh man, it really goes over the top, but that's just not accurate. Even for white people that were against slavery, I think he has a great passage where he says, I actually see if I can get it directly, where they are trying to compromise. White senators are trying to compromise on what they're going to do with regards to slavery. I'll read it as I come to it in the book. The whole thing about John Brown, again, I just echo Mr. Fuller's sentiments. He's like the only person that I have heard. I even chuckled as this passage came up, because I was reminded Dick Gregory, when I played the sound clip this couple days ago, both times he was on the program, he literally sang hymns to John Brown. Literally. If you go back in the archives. But I remember Mr. Fuller where he says, you know, to his mind, whatever John Brown did, going out to pick up arms and all that, in his mind, he still would be a suspected race soldier. And that is the exact view that I take. I don't care what he did, his sons, this is a white person, the system is still here, you're still a suspected racist. PBS did a documentary a few years back, say like 2012, 2013, where they focused on the abolitionist movement. They spent a lot of time on John Brown, and they talked about this when he met Frederick Douglass and tried to entice him to join, and Frederick Douglass knew that this was total folly and was going to be a complete failure. And then Frederick Douglass gives some of his thoughts after this happened, and later on that John Brown was right, that this was going to take violence to end that particular form of slavery, racism. But they talk about a lot of this stuff in that. Mr. Fuller also has expressed his view that it is totally incorrect if white people come to the conclusion that, you know, hey, we need to spill some blood. Violence needs to be enacted to deal with racism. Do not include black people. And pointing that out, that the first person to die in this was a black person, that right there, in my view, shows the incorrectness of this. If there's going to be some violence or what have you, already have black people who are suffering, being mistreated, being killed. Whatever your plan is, you need to make sure that it is meticulously thought out and carried out so that you do not have this where a black person is getting shot as very first person killed, some black person, and then the same thing, Dangerfield Newbie, where he gets captured and they castrate him. That should not happen at all. All of the black people, just push them to the back, step aside, let us deal with this, and then we'll come get you after we've, you know, taken care of business and you all can go about your merry way and no longer be mistreated. The mutilation that happened to black people, he's touched on that repeatedly throughout the book. Matt Turner, you can take that all the way up to present day. Eric Garner, where he had made written complaints that he had been subjected to anal cavity searches in the middle of the street by white enforcement officials. And even John Birch, the Chicago Police Department, were a part of the reparations that they just gave out to black people. They were taking electric tasers and applying them to black males' testicles. Certainly Dr. Welsing moment, attacking black genetic material, fear of white genetic annihilation. Moving forward. Yeah, and even add in taking the bodies and using them by medical students. That's big part of that is in medical apartheid, Harriet Washington. Hopefully we'll be doing that in a few weeks down the road. The white people, I think that's a common pattern as well. Thomas in New York touched on Abraham Lincoln being referred to as a black Republican. This Irishman who comes down to say, hey, you know, white people are, you know, missing out on their wages as a result of slave labor, and they strip him naked, have a black person, have a slave come and beat this person, and then they tar him, that you're not a white person. Your whiteness has been invalidated to come down here and act like you've got a problem with the way that we are operating. Our system of white terrorism, you have your white card has been revoked. And I see that sort of language being employed regularly, even to this day, the way that they talk about John Boehner, former Speaker of the House in Ohio. Had a white woman on the program. She was in the UK, no less, who kept saying that I was trying to tar her. Even that language, in my view, I think whites employ that to suggest that you are not behaving correctly as a white person, that you're not treating me like a white person, you're tarring me, the language of white supremacy. When they mentioned the city of Albany and their worship to John Brown, reminded me this week they had the big to-do in the University of Albany where the three black female students were charged with making a false report and attacking white people after they said they had been attacked on a bus. All of that went down in Albany this week where they were singing the praises in the book of John Brown and this great guy, and he did all of this to stand up to Southern tyranny. Let's see, what else did I have? Yeah, that was the few pages later, the passage that I mentioned where, this should be whole books just so that there's clarity about this. The white people in the North who oppose slavery, they are not allies to black people. They are not going to be bullied by whites, where he says the remaining delegates decided to reconvene in Baltimore on June 18th. There, the Northern Democrats refused to recede Charleston Cedars, who decided to meet across the street. Northern delegates in the main convention voiced their anger. Slave owners wanted to rule or ruin, ruling niggers all their lives. They thought they could rule white men just the same. That is a common theme that you will hear if you study this period of time, that, you know, whites from the South are going to come up here and try and boss us and treat us like niggers. Same type of metaphor that's employed. They're not treating us like equal white partners in the business, and we're going to have a problem with that. We'll have to, you know, come to a different agreement about how we're going to run the system of white supremacy. We'll fight, squabble, kill up a whole lot. Hundreds of thousands of us will get this problem solved, and then we go back to doing what we do best, dominating niggers. Let's see. Black Republican, already touched on that. Great, white people use this sort of rhetoric all the time when they feel that they're not getting their way about how the system of racism should operate, that you're advocating for equality, the niggers, you're going to let them run wild and rape your daughters. They employ that same sort of rhetoric. I think they know the power, again, going back to white genetic annihilation, they know how white people process that, and if they really want to get white people, as they say, get their blood boiling and galvanize them to do whatever they think needs to be done to preserve white domination over black people, just say that. They're raping niggers. That case in Brooklyn this week where they lied and said that these black teens had raped a white girl, and then they had to come out and drop the charges. Same thing with Central Park 5, Ben Tillman, long history of that, still running well into 2016. He had a great passage. There are a few more things I could point out, but I thought he had a really great passage where he kind of breaks all of this down in terms of white slave owners in the South and them motivating non-slave owning whites to, you know, support secession and to go with them to go against the Union. In my view, this is not racial privilege. That's the term that he uses. And, you know, I've been very clear and adamant. White privilege is not an accurate term. If what we're talking about, even if I don't own slaves, I'm a white person. So I have authority. I can participate in raping black people. I can participate in corralling a black person. If I see a black person, I can stop them, make any demands that I want of them. Where's your pass, nigger? You don't have it. I can snatch you up, beat you, take you back. I can participate in stealing black people up north. I can participate in all of that. That is not privilege. That is terrorism. That is white power. It should be described as such. In my view, that another act of racism, I would submit on the part of the author, and just not using accurate terms. This is not about preserving my white privilege as a white man. This is about me preserving white power as a white man that I have, even if I do not own slaves. I still have white power over everybody who is classified as a black person, even if they're not a quote-unquote slave, even if they're a quote-unquote free black person. I have power over them, dominion over them. I can do what I want, talk to them how I want, as a white person, a part participant in that white power, white terroristic power structure. Last thing I'll say, President James Buchanan in the American Slave Coast, he has a lot of information to submit that he was a party to helping Southerners secede. He basically says that this had been planned for a while. This was obvious that they were going to do this, that they were going to secede from the Union. And he did a lot of things to weaken the Union, to put them in a more vulnerable position to respond to this, sending the Navy halfway around the world so that they could not go respond to this quicker, sending troops out to Utah for, you know, just silliness, so that the troops would be thinned out, Union troops would be thinned out. You wouldn't have so many people to respond to this. He submits, and apparently there's a lot of people who subscribe to this theory that he did a lot. President Buchanan did a lot before leaving office at the beginning of 1861 and handing over the presidency to Abraham Lincoln to enable white Southerners to be in a more powerful position to secede, that they had been. Same thing like with closing of schools in Farmville, Virginia in 1957, that they had been planning this for a while, that it was pretty obvious that they were going to do this, and that he did quite a bit to put them in a stronger position to do so. I will stop there. Folks have anything more that they would like to share? We have about 5 minutes, and then we'll get to the second audio segment. So feel free to do so now if you have anything else you want to make sure you get in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I thought about the term Black Republican, and it made me think of the song that Nas and Jay-Z did with one another. and it makes me think of Black Republicans today. If they'd only known the root of that term is basically nigger, you know, the basically that's what it was used for, was to disparage Abraham Lincoln, which basically was to call him a nigger. I wonder how they would feel about even being quote-unquote Black Republicans or writing a song like Black Republican with that understanding. And that's what I wanted to chime in with. Oh, one more thing. The other thing, too, about the using the bodies of the African Americans as cadavers also made me think of the missing organs, like how these white people steal, like, our body parts when we're dead. I remember there was a, I think he was a either basketball or football player, where he had, like, no internal organs, they said, and that they put, like, stuffed his body with newspaper. I forget the young black male's name, and they found him rolled up in, like, a gym mat or something. Kendrick Johnson, thank you so much. That made me think of that as well. I wanted to just kind of bring that up because it seems like this happens quite a bit, and I wonder what they do with these things. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we get to the second audio segment?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just want to give a shout out for Liza. She was married twice. Black love. She first was married to Thomas Farrow, and she even built a business selling food to the travelers on steamboats. And then later she married Cabe McCullough. So black love in this instance is a revolutionary act. I'll mute my line.
Mm-hmm. I was curious to see if she got compensation. We were talking about after Cade McCollum, after he died, if they continued giving her veteran benefits. I'm thinking that's probably a precarious position to be in as a black person. They didn't give the follow-up on that. With that, some folks are good. If you have extra commentary that you want to make sure that you get in pertaining to what we heard in the first audio segment, just make a note and we should have time to share once the second audio segment concludes. Final portion of the book going to the conclusion. We are in the chapter Corpse, which I'm just curious to see how all of this is going to wrap up. This is 1861 through 1937, actually. This goes quite a bit further than just the end of the Civil War. So we'll see how Mr. Baptist wraps everything up. Thomas, and you savor what we have left. We'll be all done with the text. Context of white supremacy. Mr. Edward Baptist, suspected racist. The half has never been told. Slavery and the making of American capitalism. Context of white supremacy, audio segment number 2.
Since the beginning of the war, Lincoln had been working to convince politicians in the loyal border states to agree to gradual or compensated emancipation plans. His efforts already represented a more active support for freedom than those of all previous presidents combined. In April 1862, Congress passed a law freeing, in return for payments to enslavers totaling $1 million, all 3,000 people enslaved in the District of Columbia. Maryland, Delaware, and Kentucky politicians refused to bend, holding out for permanent slavery. Yet after the Union won its narrow victory at Antietam, Lincoln felt that he could act more decisively against slavery. He released a document he'd written months before. The preliminary Emancipation Proclamation would prove to be the most important executive order ever issued by an American president. It announced that as of January 1, 1863, any slaves in rebel-held areas would be free. The proclamation wasn't complete. It excluded the enslaved in Union-held territory, which meant not only the border states, but also the western Virginia counties that were forming themselves into a separate pro-Union state. Also exempted was southern Louisiana, where union leaders were trying to create a reconstructed state government and didn't want to antagonize local whites. Yet the Emancipation Proclamation offered the possibility of freedom to enslaved people held in the giant prison that was the Confederacy. So its tide ran ahead of the blue-coated army. Liza's Iberville Parish enslaver tried to move Liza farther from the flood to Texas. African Americans called this maneuver refugeeing. At any moment after early 1862, thousands of people were being refugeed all over the South to make it more difficult for them to trek to Union lines. But as the column of slaves was passing through Opelousas, Union raiders swooped down, scattering the Confederate guards. Marching the newly liberated people back to the river, the soldiers put Liza and hundreds of liberated African Americans onto boats bound for New Orleans. Because Liza had been in the Confederate zone, the proclamation officially freed her. But after being disembarked on the New Orleans levee, she and others were herded into the city's cotton warehouses. From there, Liza remembered, decades later, we were all scattered about to different Union-controlled plantations to do forced labor. I went on the McCall place near Donaldsonville. There she met a man named Thomas Farrow. They started a relationship. They went out into the field every day, demonstrating to Union officials a disposition to work that entitled them to receive government rations. Others resisted and went hungry. This was not quite freedom. Still, enslaved people had been knocking on the portal of freedom for decades in any way possible. Now, in a single moment, the Emancipation Proclamation had unbarred the door. Next, African Americans would force it all the way open. That opportunity was even more tangible because, as Lincoln made emancipation the policy for a long-term war that could only end with the fall of slavery's empire, another policy shifted too. Since the beginning of the war, free Northern blacks had been pushing for enlistment. The federal government, afraid of the reaction of the border states, resisted. Policymakers knew that as much as many Northern whites hated the idea of disunion, many feared even more that Frederick Douglass had been right when he'd insisted that let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., a musket on his shoulder, and bullets in his pocket, and there is no power on earth or under the earth which can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship in the United States. On January 1, 1863, Lincoln reaffirmed the Emancipation Proclamation. He also confirmed that the executive branch would fulfill Congress's summer 1862 mandate, allowing the Union Army to enlist African Americans. Many had already been drilling under individual states' authority, such as the soldiers of the famous 52nd Massachusetts Regiment. The new USCT, United States Colored Troops, also included numerous new enlistees from places such as Fortress Monroe and Camp Parapet. Soon, some enslaved men, drawn by word of mouth passed from one side of the battle lines to the other, were leaving slavery and enlisting immediately in the Union Army. One night in 1863, for instance, Cade McCallum and his friend James Douglas crept out of Madame Palang's slave quarters and set off east through the deep woods. To the north, the Union was trying to encircle Vicksburg. They reached the Mississippi and found a tiny skiff lodged against the west side. Douglas, who couldn't swim, climbed into the skiff. McCallum, in the water, held the boat's edge as he kicked it out into the stream. They drifted downriver. In the morning light, someone from the Confederate-controlled West Bank took a shot. Douglas lay in the bottom of the skiff. McCallum ducked like a turtle. A couple of other bullets whistled past. Then the shooting stopped. Around a bend loomed a Union gunboat. Seeing the stars and stripes, Douglas and McCallum hailed the crew and kicked and paddled that way. The sailors hauled the two men up the sloping iron-plated side of the Essex and told the river-soaked runaways they had a choice. They could go to Bonny Caree and do plantation labor, or they could serve in the U.S. Army. Douglas and McCallum immediately enlisted in the 80th Regiment of the USCT. Over the next 2 years, almost 200,000 other African American soldiers, many of them former slaves, did mighty things that defined the rest of their lives. McCallum and Douglas's 80th Regiment took part in the siege of Port Hudson, one of the first Civil War battles in which black troops played a major role. A Union victory there helped ensure the fall of Vicksburg in July 1863, which cut the Confederacy in half along the Mississippi. At the same time, at Gettysburg, the Union defeated the South's second invasion of the North. Now, slavery began to crumble more quickly. Blue-coated troops ranged ever more widely through the Cotton Belt. A column raided through the bayous of central Louisiana, where they rounded up Eliza and André Dupree, Fela Bati, and hundreds of other African Americans from the parishes where Solomon Northrop had toiled after he had been kidnapped from freedom. "The soldiers drove us like cattle," Bati later remembered. He and the liberated men were herded onto the tops of boxcars while the women were crowded inside them. The train unloaded Eliza Dupree and the other women onto steamers bound to leased out government farms, while the soldiers marched André Dupree, Bati, and the remaining men overland to the Mississippi, offering them the same choice that had been presented to James Douglas and Cade McCollum. André Dupree and Fela Bati joined the 81st USCT Regiment. Meanwhile, Eliza Dupree appreciated the plentiful rations available on the old Hickory labor camp. Food was getting scarce in the Confederate held areas, but she had little interest in toiling under armed supervision any longer. She slipped away, walked 50 miles to Baton Rouge, and got a job in an army hospital. A few months later, as she stirred a giant iron pot of boiling laundry outside the tents, André walked up to her through the billowing steam. His regiment was at Camp Parapet, completing its training. Someone had told him where she was, and he came to find her on a one-day pass. By 1864, the crippled Confederate Army was too weak to launch major offensives, but it could still make the Union spend oceans of blood for every advance in Virginia, Tennessee, and Georgia. The pro-war resolve of the white Northern press began to sag. Volunteering declined. Resistance to the draft increased. The weaker-willed began to talk of a negotiated peace, which was exactly what Jefferson Davis and the Confederacy were now playing for. Instead, André Dupree, James Douglas, Cade McCollum, and 200,000 other African-American men kept the faith, becoming the increment that helped the war-weary Union to persist in its efforts through 1864 and 1865. They paid a high collective price. 40,000 black soldiers died, and a similar number of African-Americans may have died in the camps and in the chaos of the war-devastated South. One day, André's brother-in-arms, Sylvester Caffrey, came to Eliza and told her that André had died of cholera. Yet there was birth as well as death in the refugee and army camps. Here, the once enslaved found each other for the first time, or again. Here they laid the groundwork for African Americans' claim to civic and political identity in a post-slavery society. For instance, take Lucinda Howard, who had been shipped from Virginia to New Orleans for sale right before the war, along with her sisters Emily and Margaret. An agent bought all three for Mrs. Wellham, who owned the Oneida labor camp in St. James Parish. Lucinda was only 15 when the Yankees came in 1862. She ran first. When her sisters and other girls whom they knew followed her, they found Lucinda at the Bonnie Curie camp, doing the heavy labor of levee repair and making a wage. They also met her man, a black soldier named Abram Blue, and they stood with her as the provost marshal, the military commandant who governed civilians in the camp, married Lucinda to Abram, under the flag, as the saying went. The certificate that the commandant gave them proved that Abram and Lucinda had been married in a legal ceremony, one sanctioned by the national state itself. Unlike pre-war marriages, which enslavers erased at whim, these weddings had the force of law. They established the claim of a man and a woman to choose to stay together, to not be separated by the desires of a white person, to make decisions for their own lives and their own blood. Abram and Lucinda brought the certificate with them when they joined a new church in Mississippi after the war. It showed that they were serious, not merely cohabiting. It made Abram the legitimate father of the 15 children Lucinda bore. And it gave Lucinda recognition as someone who had already earned citizenship by supporting Abram, a soldier citizen. That would entitle her to a claim to his pension, for she, too, had put her shoulder to the wheel of the nation. By 1864, once enslaved people were marching through almost every southern state, not in tatters and chains, but bearing arms and wearing blue uniforms with the confidence of people who believed that the federal government would back their claims to rights. Their presence encouraged still enslaved people to refuse to work for their owners or to run to the woods. The growing number of USCT enlistees also provided a crucial increment for a North that was running out of soldiers. Congress passed the 13th Amendment in March 1865, just before Lincoln's second inauguration. The amendment ended slavery throughout the United States forever, freeing people even in areas not covered by the Emancipation Proclamation, such as the 425,000 African Americans who had still been enslaved in the border states. Soon afterward, Richmond fell, and Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia surrendered at Appomattox in Southside, Virginia, on April 9, 1865. Confederate President Jefferson Davis had already fled Danville. Like the sold and stolen whom Lorenzo Ivey had seen flow by, and of whom he had spoken in his interview with Works Progress Administration worker Claude Anderson, Davis now carried his all in a little bag. After 4 years, the war was over. Although 700,000 Americans had died, mixed with the sorrow was joy. As Union troops spread throughout the remaining areas of the slave states in May and June of 1865, they found properties where people were still being held in slavery. Again and again, the scene of celebration was repeated, on days still remembered in African American communities across the country as the holiday Juneteenth for June 19th. People broke into spontaneous song and dance. Some told enslavers what they really thought. Some set off on the road with everything they had, looking for lost ones, heading back to Tennessee or Virginia, or simply looking to get away. Some literally picked up their cabins and moved them out of sight of the big house. When landowners could get the attention of those whom they had once ruled, they sometimes offered to share the proceeds of the crop 50-50. And more than one former enslaver, their world turned upside down, committed suicide on the day of Jubilee. There was one final casualty, of course. In the surviving photo from March 4, 1865, the triumphant and solemn day of Lincoln's second inauguration, you can see among the massive crowd of people covering the Capitol portico a mustached figure leaning against a pillar. For John Wilkes Booth was present for Lincoln's astonishing second inaugural address. This was, perhaps, the greatest speech ever given in the English language. It was itself a history of the half untold. It named slavery and the incessant pressures for its expansion as the reason why oceans of blood had drowned the battlefields of the Civil War. When he turned over the last page of his so brief text, Lincoln had only 40 days to live. After Richmond fell, the president went to visit. He walked through Shaco Bottom in wonder, among throngs of people celebrating freedom on the very docks from which thousands of their kin had been shipped to the cotton country. 4 million African Americans, most of whom had been enslaved when the first cannonballs plunged into Fort Sumter, had raised, over 4 years of war, a claim to freedom, to citizenship, and to relationships no one could sell. When he returned to Washington, Lincoln gave another speech in which he acknowledged this indisputable claim. Then the president announced his support for extending the vote to African American men. Their service in battle had saved the nation. Booth was in the crowd at that speech, too. He turned to a friend. Lincoln's announcement, Booth snarled, means nigger citizenship. Now, by God, I'll put him through. And on Good Friday, 1865, April 14, he murdered the president. Abraham Lincoln was either the last casualty of the Civil War or one of the first of a long civil rights movement that is not yet over. He was succeeded by his vice president, Andrew Johnson, who was unfortunately an alcoholic racist bent on undermining emancipation. Johnson spent the summer signaling to Southern whites that they could build a new white supremacy that looked much like the one African Americans had fought to end. In the fall of 1865, Southern white voters made it clear that they did not plan to come to terms with freedom. In elections intended to reseat Southern states in Congress, they sent a host of sullen Confederates back to Washington. At the same time, whites in Southern legislatures were trying to keep the status of African Americans as close to slavery as possible, passing vagrancy laws to limit mobility, proposing apprenticeship laws binding black youths as unfree laborers in white families, and making troubling threats about bringing back the whip as cotton picking rates declined. Angered by Southern whites' unwillingness to admit that they had lost the verdict of war, Northern Republicans in Congress, led by a faction called the Radicals, took control of Reconstruction. Overriding Johnson's objections, they refused to seat the newly elected Southern representatives and senators. They passed a series of bills that took the vote away from most ex-Confederate officers, and they extended the power of the Army and the Freedmen's Bureau to impose new labor systems on the Cotton South. The Freedmen's Bureau sent agents into Southern counties to mediate between land-owning, cash-poor planters and the formerly enslaved. African Americans wanted, above all, to avoid anything like the pushing system or the whipping machine. No more driver's lash, no weighing up and recording, nothing that resembled that. They wanted mothers to have a chance to care for their babies and tend their gardens. They wanted men to be able to plow without other men riding behind them with guns on their hips. They wanted children to go to school instead of doing field work all year. And African Americans throughout the South usually wanted their own land, on which they could grow subsistence crops and live as what, in another country, we would call independent peasant farmers. The freed people's dream of land went largely unfilled. The U.S. economy still needed the overseas earnings generated by the South's power in the world cotton market. Therefore, just as had been presaged in South Carolina and Louisiana during the early years of the war, neither post-war federal policymakers nor white landowners were interested in seeing the freed people become land-owning small farmers. Instead, Freedmen's Bureau agents, including many with radical political views, forced formerly enslaved people and former enslavers to sign and keep wage labor contracts for 1866. Over the next few years, a compromise system emerged across the South, various permutations of sharecropping, which meant that African American households worked individual plots of land as tenants in exchange for paying the landlord a share of the cotton crop they grew. Landowners and local store owners advanced goods on credit to sharecroppers, but at high interest rates, often trapping freed people in permanent debt. For sharecroppers, however, there was no scale, no chalk, and no whip at the end of the day. And that was no small thing. Yet the radicals also convinced Congress to pass the 14th Amendment, which, by making former slaves equal citizens of a multiracial republic, did what no other post-slavery settlement had ever done. It wrote into the Constitution a nationwide standard of birthright citizenship that would eventually enable future generations, descendants of slaves and immigrants alike, to undermine racial and cultural supremacy. Although the 14th Amendment didn't extend the vote to women, Congress, state constitutional conventions, and the press all debated the possibility. In that heady post-war time of rewriting the basic bargains of American political economy, anything seemed possible. In the short term, African American voting permitted male former slaves to make policy in state legislative halls where once deals had been brokered to securitize their own blood and seed. African Americans represented Southern states in the same Congress where compromises had formally kept the door open for more slave trades, more first days in the cotton field, more stained dirt by the gin stand. Between 1866 and the early 1870s, Reconstruction in the South seemed like it might produce a radically transformed society. White resistance was brutal and widespread, but the national commitment to emancipation kept federal troops stationed in the South. But after 1873, when the industrial economy fell into a deep recession, white America's conscience wavered. Consumed by labor disputes in the North, Republican leaders were increasingly unlikely to see the free laborers of the South as people with whom they shared interests. African Americans were watching the promise of emancipation, the heady days of eagles on brass buttons and unions under the flag, slowly begin to sag and fade, like Thomas Farrow and Liza, who moved to New Orleans after the war. She built up a business selling food to travelers on steamboats, and she bore Thomas two children. They struggled on to make free lives, but the world turned, compounding the universal tragedies of human life, amplifying failures, and speeding hope's decay. Thomas died in the 1870s during a smallpox epidemic that swept through Black Louisiana. Liza then moved to St. John the Baptist Parish and got a steady job working on the plantation of John Webb. She met Cabe McCollum, who was a supervisor there. The war had battered his body, and he could only do hard labor sporadically, but he drew the workers' respect. One day in the late 1870s, Cade's old army brother, Amos Gale, came to see him at rice-cutting time. He met Liza, who had moved herself and her two children in with Cade. Although there was nothing to eat in the house but a dried alligator hanging up there, Cade and Liza cut it down, cleaned it, and shared it with Amos. Outside the cabin, the dark was coming down. Across the South, night riders went out, hooded in white, burning, raping, beating, and killing. They stole one state's elections after another. They torched the houses of Black folks bold enough to buy land, or even bold enough to paint their own house, for that matter. They rode to Washington and made deals. To resolve the disputed presidential election of 1876, Northern Republicans made a corrupt bargain with the South's Democratic rulers to let the latter have home rule. The Redeemers, as the white Southern Democrats call themselves, changed the laws to roll back as much of Reconstruction as they could. By 1900, they had taken away the vote from most Black men and many of the less reliable white men as well. They also lowered the boom of segregation, Jim Crow, as people would come to call it, an array of petty and brutal rules. This forbade African Americans from, for instance, drinking from the same water fountains as whites, eating at the same restaurants, and attending the same schools. That is, from enjoying the civil right to move in public spaces as equals or have access to the same educational and economic opportunities as whites. Southern whites built monuments to defeated generals of their war for slavery, memorialized the old days of the plantation, and wrote histories that insisted that the purpose of the war had been to defend their political rights against an oppressive state. They were so successful at the last goal that they eventually convinced a majority of white Americans, including most historians, that slavery had been benign and that states' rights had been the cause of the Civil War. Yet the kingdom that the South's white lords had regained was a starved one. They themselves were much poorer than they had once been. Their violence was more self-destructive and less profitable. Even the new story about the old past was a kind of fool's gold. The valorization of causes lost, the delusional praising of father's treason. These things did not make one better adapted to the modern world. White entrepreneurs vigorously promoted a new South, but the region's economic decision-makers struggled to adapt to post-slavery realities. First, neither African Americans nor anyone else would do hand labor at the breakneck, soul-scarring pace of the whipping machine. Many white yeoman farmers, impoverished by war and unable to pay debts or taxes, lost their land and became tenants and sharecroppers themselves. The total number of bales produced in the United States didn't surpass 1859's peak until 1875, despite a significant increase in the number of people making cotton in the South after emancipation. Cotton productivity dropped significantly. Many enslaved cotton pickers in the late 1850s had peaked at well over 200 pounds per day. In the 1930s, after a half century of massive scientific experimentation, all to make the Cotton Bowl more pickable. The great-grandchildren of the enslaved often picked only 100 to 120 pounds per day. Second, both because productivity was now declining instead of rising, and because of the political-economic isolation that the South's white rulers inflicted upon their region in order to protect white power, the South sank into subordinate colonial status within the national economy. Although many Southerners wanted to develop a more diverse modern economy that went beyond cotton, for nearly a century after emancipation, they failed to do so. Despite constant attempts to industrialize, the South could only offer natural resources and poverty-stricken laborers. It did not have enough local capital, whether of the financial or the well-educated humankind, and it could not develop it. Although a textile industry sprang up in the Piedmont of the Carolinas and Virginia, and an iron and coal industry in Alabama, they offered mostly low-wage jobs. Non-textile industries suffered in the competition with more heavily capitalized northern industries, which literally rigged the rules, such as the price structures that corporations used to ensure that Pittsburgh's steel would cost less than Birmingham. Extractive industries, including coal mining and timber, devastated the landscape and depended on workforces oppressed with shocking violence. The continued small size and poverty of the non-agricultural working class also limited urban and middle-class development. Thus, in the 1930s, a lifetime after the Civil War, the majority of both black and white Southerners were poor and worked on farms, often farms they did not own. Liza was in her 40s when she and Cade got together. Sarah to his Abraham, she still bore two children by him. In 1882, the couple finally got officially married. A few years later, they moved to New Orleans. In 1890, 68 years old, he first applied for an invalid pension from the federal government, which had committed itself to support old soldiers and their widows after the soldiers died. On his application, he listed many ailments. Some were typical of old age. Some were especially likely among those who had suffered through forced migration, hard labor, and soldier service in mud and rain. Intestinal disorders, old injuries, a fluttering heart that left him exhausted. After 16 years in the Carlton neighborhood, he died. It was February 1906. The family laid him out in his blue uniform. The old veterans from the neighborhood came by to pay their respects, and they slowly walked him to his tomb. On that cold day, as Liza walked back from the cemetery to the house where she would now have to live with her son and his family, not only was Cade McCollum lying dead in his tomb, what was worse was that he seemed to have been defeated, and Liza too. Slavery was gone, but Jim Crow was alive. Almost all Southern African Americans were shut out of the ballot box and the political power it could yield. Segregated public accommodations and schools promised that they and their descendants would be second-class citizens for the foreseeable future. The young people who took the train north to Chicago and New York found that even outside of the South, they faced segregated workplaces and neighborhoods, a door of opportunity only intermittently and partially open. But the body of African America, stretched and chained and stretched again, the body whose tongue and spirit and blood had developed alongside slavery's expansion, was still alive. For the history in which Cade and Liza and millions of others had been caught up, the history that had been stolen from them and which people were always trying to steal from them, was not over, and in many ways still is not. Slavery and its expansion had built enduring patterns of poverty and exploitation. This legacy was certainly crystal clear in Liza's early 20th century South. African American households had virtually no wealth, for instance, while a substantial portion of the wealth held by white households, even after emancipation, could be traced to revenue generated by enslaved labor and financing leveraged out of their bodies before 1861. More broadly, the history of feet and heads, hands, tongues, breath, seed, blood, and backs and arms had made all of African America, the United States, and the modern world. The shaping began in the 1780s. The possibility of profit from forced migration kept the United States together through the lean years after the American Revolution. The Constitution's compromises built a union on slavery and embedded its expansion, some thought temporarily, some thought permanently, in the fabric of the American political economy. For the 70 years that followed, a full biblical lifespan, enslaved people were marched and shipped south and west. African Americans' hands and creativity, turned against themselves and even against each other at times, made commodities and built an archipelago of slave labor camps, a literal organism of economic production. From markets built on the labor and the bodies of enslaved people, and from the infrastructure laid down to ship the product in and out, came economic growth. But from this economic growth came not only wealth, but also political power in the councils of the nation. Poor white men insisted that they too should enjoy the psychic rewards of right-handed power on slavery's frontier. And from that came temporary defeat for arrogant planters. Yet clever political entrepreneurs, most notably Andrew Jackson, turned assertively populist energies into the channels of political power too. They created a new interregional political alliance that yielded decades more of compromise and that enabled the South to maintain its disproportionate power within the federal government. Still, both South and North depended on slavery's expansion. The products generated from the possibilities of co-exploitation explain much of the nation's astonishing rise to power in the 19th century. Through the booms and the crashes emerged a financial system that continuously catalyzed the development of U.S. capitalism. By the 1840s, the United States had grown into both an empire and a world economic power, the second greatest industrial economy, in fact, in the world, all built on the back of cotton. Dependence on cotton stretched far beyond North American shores. A world greedy for a slice of the whipping machine's super profits had financed the occupation of the continent, and the forced migration of enslaved African Americans to the southwestern cotton fields helped to make the modern world economy possible. The steadily increasing productivity of hands on the cotton frontier kept cheap raw materials flowing to the world's newest and most important industry, the cotton textile factories of Britain, Western Europe, and the North. Theft of days, years, labor, of the left hand's creative secrets, helped provide the escape velocity for the fledgling modern world to do what no other historical society had done before, and pull away from the gravitational field of the Malthusian cul-de-sac. Slavery's expansion was the driving force in U.S. history between the framing of the Constitution and the beginning of the Civil War. It made the nation large and unified, and it made the South's whites disproportionately powerful in that nation. Enslavers had turned right hand against left to achieve not only productivity, but also power that few other dominant classes in human history had possessed. Yet from the epic of theft and survival, of desire and innovation, came the Civil War, too. Expansion's profits and power made Southerners willing to push for more expansion. This made some Northern whites into allies, who recognized their dependence on cotton profit and were willing to do what was necessary to keep it flowing. These were Southern whites' allies. But Southern power frightened other Northern whites. Some feared that slavery, acceptable enough when it remained a Southern institution, would invade the places they lived or wanted to live. Others believed that slavery corrupted everything, and that its expansion fed the rot in American society, American freedom, the American soul, whatever category was their touchstone for everything good. Still others believed that the financial disasters of the late 1830s and early 1940s showed that slavery was economically derelict, doomed, a drag on the capitalist economy's future. All those groups united in the Republican Party of the late 1850s behind the one policy position on which they could all agree, that slavery's expansion must be stopped. For white Southerners, who had always been able to find new frontiers, the victory of that party in a national election was too much. Buoyed by their other successes in the 1850s, by the nearly complete consensus of white Southerners behind the slaveholder political bloc, and their overwhelming power within the National Democratic Party, enslaver politicians made decisions for secession and then for war. It has been said that the Civil War was unnecessary because slavery was already destined to end, probably within a few decades after the 1860 election. Yet this is mere dogma. The evidence points in the opposite direction. Slavery yielded ever more efficient production, in contrast to the free labor that tried and failed to compete with it, and the free labor that succeeded it. If slave labor in cotton had ever hit a wall of ultimate possibility, enslavers could have found new commodities. Southern enslavers had adapted slavery before, with incredibly profitable results. Forced labor, that is slavery in everything but name, remained tremendously important to the world economy well into the 21st century. And the lessons that enslavers learned about turning the left hand to the service of the right, forcing ordinary people to reveal their secrets so that those secrets could be commodified, played out in unsteady echoes that we have called by many names: scientific management, the stretch out, management studies, and heard in many places. Though these were not slavery, they are one more way in which the human world still suffers without knowing it from the crimes done to Rachel and William and Charles Ball and Lucy Thurston, mourns for them unknowing, even as we also live on the gains that were stolen from them. Nor is it obvious that slavery's expanders would have been politically defeated, outnumbered, or boxed in. In the 1850s, slavery expansion's promoters were making continued expansion defensible in constitutional terms that the North found quite acceptable long after the war. In addition, the vast enslaved body was the biggest store of wealth in the American economy. So long as law and normal politics reign, wealth holders typically find ways to preserve their wealth. Successful revolt from within was impossible, so war was the only way slavery would end in the United States. War is what the enslavers, in their right-handed arrogance, launched, and it was, for them, a tremendous mistake. Yet Cade McCollum was dead in his tomb. So were many of the men and women who with him had seized the finally here chance that enslavers' overreach had opened up to enslaved men and women, a generation that had made sure that they would finally see the end of it. But dead, too, it seemed, were the dreams of equality, independence, of redeeming the thefts of slavery's deepest, longest journeys. Liza, toiling up the street in the cold, might have seen little chance of reversing the process of decay. In 1937, when Claude Anderson came to talk to Lorenzo Ivy, she might have still said the same thing. Indeed, though former enslavers and their descendants had lost much of their power through defeat in the Civil War, they had regained some of it by the early 20th century. The Southern white elites continued to wield disproportionate power through the next 100 years. The willingness of many white Southerners to unite around the idea of hanging on to racial power made the South a swing region, and white Southerners a defined interest group, willing to rejoin whichever national party was willing to cater to its demands. That was only one of the ways in which the bitter fruit of the Southern elites, and their defense of slavery and of their own power, continued to gall democracy everywhere in the country. In another case, the federal judiciary took the Calhounian argument for the independence of slave property from majority control and made it, in the form of the so-called Lochner Doctrine, a defense of rampant industrial power in the face of attempts to regulate workers' safety, consumer health, and environmental impact. In yet another case, the scientific racism had a long history after the fall of the Confederacy. It was used to justify anti-Semitism, the extermination of native peoples around the world, brutal forms of colonialism, and the exclusion of immigrants. And it continued to be used to justify discrimination against the descendants of the enslaved. Meanwhile, the unbending anger of former Confederates against Reconstruction morphed into their grandchildren's suspicion of the New Deal, and the insistence on the part of white Southern Democrats that measures against the Depression could do nothing to alleviate black poverty or lessen white supremacy. Compared to their dominance of U.S. politics through much of the antebellum period, and their ability to consume disproportionate quantities of the fruits of antebellum national economic growth, the post-war Southern white upper class achieved only a truncated triumph. Yet, white folks still kept the black folks who toiled for them in poverty, forcing African Americans to take the implicit and explicit insults of life in the Jim Crow South in silence, lest they die brutally at the hands of mobs with or without badges. No wonder so many African Americans saw no chance for freedom but to leave. Still, there were things that, for all their power, even the pre-Civil War enslavers themselves had not been able to control. They would create a system that seemed to reduce African Americans to body parts, feet walking like a chained machine, hands on the block and hands picking, minds and nervous systems yielding revenue, providing entertainment and pleasure. Yet there were two ways to look at the body of African America, sutured together in the trauma of slavery's expansion. The body had two forms, two instances. One profited enslavers, and in fact, white America, North and South, had again and again agreed to co-exploit this body, which was the new slavery of the cotton fields. This African America, created by expansion, was marked by vast suffering. In it, hundreds of thousands of people died early and alone, separated from their loved ones. Millions of people were lost by millions of people. By the water's edge, they parted. But tongues also spoke words that enslavers did not hear. Lungs breathed a spirit that would not yield. Enslaved men and women watched and guarded and stilled their blood and trained their seed to wait. Even when enslavers realized, in particular moments, that enslaved people had created something else, an identity, a political unity, a common culture, a story, and a sense of how it shaped them and made them one, enslavers had forgotten or willed themselves to forget. So people survived and helped each other to survive, and not only to survive, but to build. Thus, another body grew as the invisible twin of the one stretched out and used by white people. Eventually, the waiting had its reward. The body rose. African Americans took up arms and defeated the enslavers. Survival, and this kind of survival, made victory possible. Unlike its predecessors on the North American mainland, and unlike counterparts in most of the New World, the African American culture that emerged from the crucible of 19th century forced migration within the United States had no alternative but to think of itself as a political unity. Assimilation, sought by enslaved Africans and their descendants in both Brazil and in many Spanish-speaking societies, was impossible. Escape through individual manumission, an option pursued by enslaved strivers throughout the rest of the New World, was usually impossible. Escape through revolt, relying on old African identities and concepts, the Haitian option, was likewise impossible. All of these options closed, enslaved African Americans had to develop a sense of unity or crumble. And they did develop that unity, bending a narrative of history that bound them together around a clear-eyed assessment of their situation as victims of a vast crime. They had to recognize that without solidarity, they would live only at the whim of a set of structures and practices designed to exploit them in every possible way. The political agenda that enslaved people developed and that they exported in the words of survivors and runaways was not assimilation, not manumission, but destruction for the whipping machine and everything that made it work, and the transformation of America into a place that would redeem its thefts. This agenda, smuggled north in the minds and on the tongues of an intrepid and lucky few escapees, resurrected a dead anti-slavery movement in the United States. This agenda set a group of progressive whites on a political collision course with the slave lords and their many northern allies. Even as that political trajectory unfolded, in spaces sacred and secular, during the day and during the night, in pain and in joy, enslaved people were still finding new ways to protect and defend the human soul in the midst of the still unfolding chaos of creative destruction. They made survival and form out of terror, theft, and death. They learned to be fast but not hurried, to lose themselves without losing their souls. All this was also the legacy of slavery's expansion. This was the collective body that survived forced migration, even as many bodies did not survive it, or died in the war that ended it, or suffered through impoverishment and disfranchisement in the wake of Reconstruction. In the war, survivors ended slavery. When the survivors began to die off, they could pass on to their descendants very little in the way of material wealth. So much had been stolen from them. But African Americans had a story that made them a people. They had a unity that was ultimately political. This had led them to choose solidarity over individual deals. They had lodged their claim to citizenship in the Constitution, a precedent that would grow in leverage as the country went on, and the United States found itself up against enemies eager to point to the hypocrisy of first-class language and second-class practice of civil and political equality. They had, with white allies, created in the form of abolitionism the ideological template of American descent, of progressivism, of the faith that social change, pursued with religious zeal, could make America truer to its ideal self. At the same time, from lands devastated by forced migration, creativity continued to boil forth in the years after Reconstruction's collapse. African-American cultural forms permeated and reworked American popular culture, which then exported these cultural forms to the entire globe. Over the century that followed Cade McCollum's burial, using all these tools, working in all sorts of métiers, African-American people transformed the world. They remade the social, cultural, and political geography of the United States through their own volition in the course of the Great Migration. They changed the South and the United States and the world forever through the Civil Rights Movement. And they built a tradition of community organization that eventually led the American electorate, in an astonishing development, to elect a black president who was the son of an African immigrant. As a political force, the solidarity that African Americans first built while still enslaved remains impressively coherent generations later, despite two centuries of temptations to give up, turn aside, or dissolve into nihilism. The descendants of enslaved African Americans could do these mighty deeds for many reasons, but one root of every reason was this. Those who survived slavery had passed down what they had learned. The gifts, the creations, the breath of spirit, songs that saved lives, lessons learned for dimes, the ordinary virtues, and the determination to survive the wolf. The lessons came down in the strong arms that held babies in sharecroppers' cabins, in the notes of songs, in the rocking of churches, in jokes told around the water bucket on hot days of cotton picking, and in lessons taught in both one-room schoolhouses and at places like Hampton. Day after day, year after year, the half untold was told, and in the tomb, the body stirred. The wind washed the sun clear of clouds. Claude Anderson scribbled the last few words with his pencil and then noticed that the old man had come to a stop. The sunlight had marched far across the pine board floor. It must be well past noon. Glancing up, Anderson saw Lorenzo Ivy looking at him with a calm smile, one that belied the catalog of horrors he had detailed. Outside, children were calling to each other in wild play. Anderson heard two pairs of bare feet shooting down the street in chase. He could feel the dirt kicking out behind his own heels only a few years since. Somewhere across the sea, people peered up through the barbed wire at guard towers. The story being told to justify the machine guns was one of the prisoners' subhuman race. It was a story told with phrases that the defenders of slavery had coined to claim their righteous hold on Ivy when he had been a child. Somewhere across the sea, a man in a gulag huddled under a blanket woven from cotton picked by Anderson's and Ivy's lost cousins. Somewhere across the ocean, a child in a tavern entrance heard a record playing, heard a shocking combination of correctness and violation, a trumpet singing a new song. Somewhere, in fact at the far end of the same old slave trail that led through Danville and over the mountain, a mother huddled by Mississippi's Highway 61 with her children. Put out with the coming of the tractor, she clutched a Chicago address in her hand. And somewhere, not far from Danville, Law students three generations from slavery huddled, planning the next move against Jim Crow and lynching. Another shift of wind shook the curtains. Another minute had marched the sun further, to an angle that suddenly cast the deep wrinkles on Ivy's face into relief. He rose, creaking audibly. Sometimes these old men wanted chewing tobacco. Anderson often gave the women snuff. Ivy's hand only asked for a grip.
I know a lot more I can tell you some other time. I'll write it out. Just send me an envelope, like you said, and I'll write it all down and send it to you.
Anderson thanked him, and he stepped through the door the old man held open. He walked down the steps, opened the door of his black Ford, dropped his notepads on the passenger side, and slid into the driver's seat. He started the engine and leaned his head out through the roll-down window. The old man was still on the porch.
Be good now,
Lorenzo Ivy said, and turned back through the open door. This concludes the reading of The Half Has Never Been Told, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism by Edward E. Baptist.
Context of white supremacy. Another one bites the dust. Folks have commentary. Feel free to chime in. The number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Number one, I wanted to get in. Our listeners in Canada would definitely say that just because you are north of the U.S.-Canada border does not mean that you are free, no longer subject to the system of racism, white supremacy. I think they pointed that out pretty consistently since we've had more Canadian listeners participating on the program, that gets stated a lot, that Canada is a haven for Negroes, and nothing could be further from the truth. 18th century, 21st century, whichever time period you would like to discuss. The other point that I wanted to get in, follow-up to this book, if people wanted to do more reading to just get additional details, kind of where this left off. Certainly, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy would be a great one to get more detail about the terrorism that ensued after the conclusion of the Civil War. I mentioned America Aflame, which gives a lot of detail about the conflict leading up to the Civil War, and then a lot of detail about the terrorism after the Civil War, as I said. LaRon Bennett, Forced into Glory, black author, outstanding information to just demystify and debunk notions of Abraham Lincoln as some non-racist, well-meaning white guy. Outstanding text. All of these are bigger book we have done, Ben Tillman and the Reconstruction of White Supremacy, but the other two books, they are pretty beefy books, but they have pretty solid information if we have folks out there who are into history and getting more details about this sort of thing. I think even W.E.B. Du Bois' book on the history of Reconstruction also is a great one, with a lot of information about the terrorism that white people methodically meted out to black people after the Civil War. Even I'm reminded of Richard Williams' Black and White, The Way I See It, where he talks in detail about having to sneak off of a plantation, and this is in the 20th century, his family having to sneak off of a plantation at midnight on the threat of being killed. And I guess the final one would be Douglas Blackman, Slavery by Another Name, guest on the program, who talks about this is just a different phase of slavery, white supremacy that continued well on, continues to this day. I would submit slavery is white supremacy is slavery. But if you wanted additional reading to kind of pick up where this book concludes, folks have comments they would like to share, feel free. All done. Roz, Thomas in New York, Mr. Demery 4, you all should be with us. I'll nab any other hands as I see them. Folks have comments that they would like to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, amen to the comment on Canada. You're absolutely right. yeah, I was just thinking to all of those black people, Cade McCallum, Eliza, James Douglas, Andre Dupree, Abraham and Lucinda in the last section, how they tried to really maintain their family and really bond and create something lasting, were just incredible examples of Black self-respect. These are people whose names will end up on my ancestral altar. I truly believe that those people whose names aren't well known should be uplifted just as much as those who are very famous for their work in fighting racism and white supremacy. I found on page 406, there was a very telling section where after the slaves were freed, they said in one sentence, it said, in more than one former enslaver, their world turned upside down, committed suicide on the day of Jubilee. And all I could think is, dead white people are great. When you're fighting in a war, anytime they go, you should be smiling and cheesing. It made me think of recently, I don't know if anyone else might have heard about this, but recently Jamie Foxx had saved a white man who was trapped in a car that was on fire. And he went through all this rigmarole, almost got himself burnt up to get this white man out of the car. And I remember when I heard that on the news, I read the article online, and I said to myself, wow, if that was me, he would have been barbecued. I would have just walked away as quickly as possible, and he would have just been barbecued, and I would have just celebrated another enemy gone. So that made me think of that. Also, on page 408, they had a brief section that said, it wrote into the Constitution a nationwide standard of birthright citizenship that would eventually enable future generations, descendants of slaves and immigrants alike, to undermine racial and cultural supremacy. I felt that that was an act of racism by the author. It doesn't matter how many people, non-white people, they provided birthright citizenship to. Matter of fact, it was my birth. I'm the sole person in my family born in the United States. Everyone, including my sister, was born in Trinidad and Tobago. And it was because of my birth they were given citizenship it was immediate citizenship based on the fact that my mother had me here. And you know, regardless of how many non-white people they give citizenship to, it has done nothing to undermine the system of racism and white supremacy, not in the last 500 years. And right now, they're actually trying to turn Hispanics into the proxy racists of the future. So I believe that was such an overt, blatant act of racism. It was kind of nauseating to even read it. There was a section on the following page, 409, that states, Cade's old army brother, Amos Gale, came to see him at rice-cutting time. He met Liza, who had moved herself and her two children in with Cade. Although there was nothing to eat in the house but a dried alligator hanging up there, Cade and Liza cut it down, cleaned it, and shared it with Amos. My goodness, this gave me a serious flashback, because I remember one thing my mother always told me growing up was, no matter how poor they were in Trinidad, her mother always told her, you always have something, at least food, to share with anyone who comes through your home. And I remember very vividly being in Trinidad with my grandmother and watching her kill a chicken. She had a chicken farm. She killed the chicken, cleaned it, and actually that was the first time I'd ever seen a pot that could fit all four burners on the stove. And she cooked soup and had me go to all the elderly females and males that she knew throughout the neighborhood, bringing them bowls of soup. And that section where they had nothing but this dried alligator and they took it down and they shared it really speaks to our communal nature that has totally been savaged and destroyed as a result of racism, white supremacy. And it just really made me think of my grandmother and just how much even my mother carried that tradition in a lot of ways, the way we were raised growing up. And on page 412, you know, the section that says, for 310 years that followed, a full biblical lifespan, enslaved people were marched and shipped south and west. African Americans' hands and creativity turned against themselves and even against each other at times, made commodities and built an archipelago of slave labor camps, a literal organism of economic production. I thought of that as a literal organism of people dominated by racism, white supremacy. And it also made me think to something that I said before, and it might have been during the reading of this book, but I know I said it on another episode before. White people function as a planetary white supremacist superorganism, and that is exactly how they used us. And by dominating us the way they have, especially most intensely for the last 500 years, we have become a super organism of basically enslaved people, and that's all non-white people I'm speaking of. Also, the following page, 413, there's a section that says, slavery's expansion was the driving force in U.S. history between the framing of the Constitution and the beginning of the Civil War. It made the nation large and unified, and it made South's whites disproportionately powerful in that nation. Enslavers had turned right hand against left to achieve not only productivity, but also power that few other dominant classes in human history had possessed. And right there, to me, it just speaks to their unification. It was really unified under racism, white supremacy. And the way that this is written, it just really speaks to the fact that everything that America is had to do with white people unifying under the system of white supremacy and their coordinated efforts to basically commit genocide and terrorize black people. There was another section on 416 that said assimilation sought by enslaved Africans and their descendants in both Brazil and many Spanish-speaking societies was impossible. Escape through individual manumission, an option pursued by enslaved drivers throughout the rest of the world, was usually impossible. Escape through revolt relying on old African identities and concepts, the Haitian option, was likewise impossible. All of these options, enslaved African Americans had to develop a sense of unity or crumble. And they did develop that unity, bending a narrative of history that bound them together around a clear-eyed assessment of their situation. And it says, as victims of a vast crime, I crossed those words out in the book and put victims of white supremacy. And I think it really speaks to the fact that today, like the brilliance of Neely Fuller's work and a lot of the work that Dr. Wilson has done is the fact that we have been so fragmented that and just culturally dominated by such foreign racist white supremacist concepts, it just seems like it's going to be almost impossible for us to unify. But if we can at least have the United Independent concept, that code and concept, that gives us something, a benchmark for us to strive at least together to fight the biggest problem that the world has ever dealt with, which is racism, white supremacy. I found that there was an act of racism, again, by the author, on page 417, just an end section of a paragraph, he said, they had, with white allies, created in the form of abolitionism, the ideological template of American descent, of progressivism, of faith that social change pursued with religious zeal could make America truer to its ideal self. I felt that that is an act of racism because America is racism. It was Dr. Wilson who talked about the fact that America, the word America, is an anagram, meaning I am race. So there's nothing more American than racism, white supremacy. There's nothing more American than lynching, castrating, and killing black people and raping black people and brutalizing black people. And thank you for choosing this book. I thought it was phenomenal. I'm looking forward to the next one that we plan to do. And also, I just wanted to ask if you got my guest suggestion for Jacob Holt.
Yes. Oh, yes, sir. Yes, I did.
Wonderful. Just peruse his site. If you haven't, you're going to be pleased with a lot of what he's done. But I'll mute my line there and give someone else a chance to speak.
For sure. Anybody else that has a hand up, if you all had commentary that you wanted to get in, feel free.
Yes, may I be here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that was well said. I'll just like to speak on what happened to the ex-slaves after the Civil War and how a lot of these plantations ended up being union-controlled labor camps where the ex-slaves were forced to work for little or no wages, mistreated by the Union soldiers, starved, sick from unsanitary conditions, and a lot of them contracted diseases from burying the dead, which, if it was 700,000 people killed during the Civil War, you know, a lot of them had to be buried, so you know where that job ended up going. And when it spoke briefly about Robert E. Lee's Arlington's home, which is Arlington Cemetery. Now the blacks or the slaves that were on that plantation became the first black federal workers by becoming grave diggers for the Union soldiers. And Frederick Douglass for pushing for black enlistment, and eventually, I guess, swaying Lincoln's turning the tide of the Civil War, you know, based upon work that he had done to get this passed. And when faced with slavery or military service, the black men chose Union service. And in a lot of those states where the word didn't get around to those slaves, they were still working as slaves even after the Emancipation Proclamation. The slave owners didn't tell the slaves, and were got around later, and so to this day, June 19th is celebrated, I know, in some parts of Texas to this day. And then it spoke briefly about the night riders and, you know, doing Reconstruction. Every time black people would make a little bit of progress, then the terrorism and violence was ramped up, and so the night riders, hooded in white, would come burning, raping, beating, and killing. And they stole more than one state election, one after another. So I'll mute my line on that. Thanks for taking the call, and looking forward to the next book. I'll mute my line.
For sure. Any of our other folks who dialed in have comments they wanted to make sure that they got in?
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Thank you for taking my call. I was just thinking, I just wanted to add that you had some guests on that I can't remember the book that they were talking about, but he said that he said that when you think slavery, he said something to the effect, whereas you think, you know, slavery was bad. He said it's even worse when you really look at it. And that's kind of reminded me of this title, like The Half Has Never Been Told. It's like, as bad as you think it is, you know, it was even worse. And I think it was because of the sophistication of the system and whatnot. I just wanted to say, thanks for bringing this book to us, and I hope that we share it, because the half has never been told. Like in 2016, we're still finding out, we find out the serious things about what went on, how the system worked in 2016, like brand new. Research and findings and whatnot. So I just wanted to say, I hope we share this book with people, and because The Half Has Never Been Told, it's a lot to it. As bad as you think it is, it was even worse. I think that statement, some people might say because of the abuse or whatever, but I think more to me it just means the sophistication of it, how they really seen us as human resources, and how it's really going on today, the exact same things, it's going on today, you know what I'm saying? So just share this because it's important. This is new findings, and I think it can explain a lot of help people, helps understanding, and gets rid of a lot of the confusion. And then I was going to say, I got an elder, turns 99 next month, and we're gonna, he's sharp, man. His brain, he has no dementia, nothing. It's just his body is a little bit, worn down, but he's gonna be 99, And one of the callers was saying that his grandmother, he remembers the traditions that his grandmother had and whatever. Yo, that's true, man. Like, our elders, like, some of the stuff that my elder was telling me, like, from, you know, that yeah, 99 that I didn't know about, it kind of lets you know, like, what they went through, what we are going through now. Like, you know, like, we're... we're standing on their shoulders, and it's really unbelievable, man. So, like, I hope that we talk to our elders a little bit more than we do, because even, like, a grandmother, well, it depends on how young you are, but they can tell you some stuff, man, about, like, how racism, white supremacy was working back then, and they might not know all the terms and everything like that, but you're going to get the picture, you know, if you just give them a chance to talk about, you know, how they had to live and work in the system, you know. So I wanted to say, like, let's talk to our elders, interview them. Maybe, you know, so thank you again, Gus, for giving us this book, man. It's very important. 2016, wow.
Ashe on that. Happy birthday. That definitely underlined that in terms of the significance. A lot of the information in this text, things that they got from talking to black people that were elderly black people in the I guess it'd be like early, mid 1900s, who were former, put that in quotes, former slaves, just talking about their experience before they transitioned. Say that all the time. That is an invaluable resource that we should not take for granted, talking to older black people, a la Dr. Welsing, Mr. Fuller, talking to older black people, Dr. Cambon. What was their experience like? What did they see? What did they experience? That people that talk about... talking to their children about racism, I have said that consistently. Sit down with grandmothers, grandfathers, uncles, even if they're not family members, just older black people that you know and have a relationship with. Sit down and talk to them for an afternoon. That can give you a lot more than you can get from a book or a film, to have somebody that you know sit down and talk to you about some of their experiences, if they're willing to open up and be honest. Even a lot of the books that we've read that give this information, that's how they got a lot of this, what they call primary sources. Isabel Wilkerson, just going to talk to black people who migrated from the South, who went to Chicago or went to California, wherever they ended up at. Outstanding information about racism, white supremacy, just going to talk to black people. Maybe they don't have a PhD or what have you, but they certainly got a PhD in victim of white supremacy, and they can share a lot of info with you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I agree with what everyone said. I don't have the books. I can't read the text, but a lot of that last reading, I think that the author was practicing racism. One thing I did like that he said is, and I say this all the time, that, you know, the words black, colored, nigger, negro, African-American, and I really felt like every time he said African American in the book, I cringed, because those were African Americans. Those were slaves. You know, they had no, they weren't Americans at all. You know, they sell that, those words that they use to sell a culture worldwide, to sell an ideology, and use us, and, you know, it sells everywhere in the world. You know, the book was great. Well, you know, just from the start, when I learned that with the F word meant, I mean, I knew this book was going to be good. I was like, oh, I always wanted to know it. You know, where did that come from? But just an awesome book. Awesome read. I can't wait for the next one. You know, I was watching, I was listening to the radio. You know, Pandora had an old school station on. And they played a Public Enemy song, Can't Trust This. But don't trust it. And, you know, afterwards, you know, I'm on YouTube trying to find the song, and I found it, and I watched the video, and it just so reminded me of, you know, all you've been saying, how black didn't, you know, they stopped up to the racists. You know, they weren't, no, just sitting there taking it, they didn't sit under there. And I think that video did a lot of showing that, you know, they stood up, they fought back, you know. I thought it was just a great black self-respect. It brought me right to this book and the other book where the people came on the American slave course. Wanted to ask Gus. Really, I had a question for Mr. Demery. I just wanted to know, where was Mr. Demery located? And what was the name of the next book is what I had to ask you, Gus. I forgot what you said.
Wow, that is fascinating. Leonita McLean. Leonita McLean, that's her name, and it's a foot in each world. It might even be a foot in both worlds, but same thing, basically. It's she was a journalist. She wrote essays, most of them dealing with racism, and she eventually committed suicide, but they posthumously published a collection of all of her essays, and it's titled A Foot in Both Worlds, Leonita McLean. I guess, Mr. Demery Ford, did you want to divulge where you are?
I'm in the Maryland area.
There you go.
Okay, I got you, He's in Grand Hill. Thank you.
For sure. Foot in each world. Had it correct. Foot in each world. Caller at 2456, 2456. Did you have a comment you wanted to get in?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling from the 712. This book was, it was too much for me. I sat here and sat through it, so I'm so glad it's over. It got a lot of jewels in it, but it was just, it should be marked under horror, really, because it was like a horror story. True accounts of some of the things that happened to our ancestors. To answer that question about black women was supposed to have some type of leverage, I had to really sit and think about that. I don't know why, but I just had to think about it, and I don't see how any leverage could have been used. I kind of started talking to, you know, my other people that listened to the book study too, and they were like, we were debating if you could use death, if you could use your suicide, but I mean, they could just kill you, and they could just rape you. So what leverage could you have? It'd be interesting if you could get Batiste on the program. We could ask him, like, what leverage could a black enslaved black woman have over a slave owner, slave master? And I don't know. Main points I got from the book is just that these white people that they were talking about in this book is the same white people that's walking around right now. That's the main thing I got from the book, and I think we need to remember that. And with us, I guess a big part of it is denial or, you know, fear as well. But it's the same white people, the same people they were saying in this book is the same people that are walking around today, and we need to really get that sunk in. And I took a lot of notes, but my notebook, I'm somewhere else, and my notebook is somewhere else. So, it's a disturbing book. It had jewels in it, true enough, but just the cutting off of the breast and just beating a one-year-old, you know, till they, you know, because they wouldn't pick cotton. It's just a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm
Are you saying Jews or jewels?
Jewels. Yes. I'm ready to move on to the next book. But all right, thanks for taking my call, Cal. Hello to everybody on the line and listeners as well. Thank you.
Hey, can I say something?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I definitely agree. This was a brutal book. It's probably the second most brutal that I read that I've engaged in since I've been participating in the book study session. I think the hardest read was Henrietta Lacks. That was just I felt that, you know, so deep. And I just wanted to say, as far as the slavery aspect goes, I just feel like the way it's always portrayed to us is like it was just a period of time. And, get over it. And you look at all they built, I mean, look at all the advancement in this country, all the buildings and everything that's been built. And this is all based off the back of slavery or the credit and the financial system that was built off of the back of slavery. And I've always said, you know, I don't really think that we, you know, get the reparations, but, you know, they owe us something. And not only the Americans, but all of the people that participated in bringing blacks to this part of the world, I mean, it has to be massive. I mean, for what we lost just in this one read, if you look at what we lost over the years or what we weren't able to gain as a result of slavery, and it's just, I mean, the only way we'll ever be on an equal playing field financially or you know, with that type of security is if we do get some financial, you know, restitution from these people, because they're not going to give it up any other way. And I think this book just really hit it at home. And like the Katrina book, we read that because it was so detailed. I felt like this one was detailed. I think this should be a mandatory read, and for all black kids, just to see how it really played out, you know, just to get it in the gist of the real system. And as for the women on the plantation, you know, I was watching a movie. I reference this movie every now and then, called Goodbye, Uncle Tom. And they show how it gives the portrayal that women, black women on the plantation, if they were more, you know, like they have no rights, so they can be raped at any time. But if they were more willing, if they were more willing to play the role of the, you know, the whore, you know, be more engaging sexually, they were allowed to have certain privileges within the household that the other slaves didn't get. And I had said before that I agreed that they did get some type of, you know, women, they have some type of incentive. And I think it kind of showed out in the movie Django with Candy there with his black female who, even though she's still a slave and it has no rights, she has a lot more power over the other blacks than a regular black slave would have. And that's what I meant as far as women having a little bit of a leverage. And I mean, Marlon, thank you.
Right on.
Can I say one thing?
Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, did you peep out the authors of American Slave Coast, how they said, how they referenced Afropop?
He's written extensively. Like, he's a musician. He's written several books, like award-winning books, on African musicians and all that, and tying that in with racism. Like, it reminded me of Gwendolyn Midloe Hall.
I was just about to bring, she's on Afropop. They have major scholars doing major work on these African, I mean, on these black, I'm sorry, I said African, but on these black, I mean, and Afropop, if you guys ain't hip to Afropop, man, you know, go to that site, and there's white people, man, they do a major scholarship on black people. Like, I mean, they're learning the language, they're doing the history of, like, you know, different parts of the, you know, African diet, you know, African American so-called diaspora, and how this all goes. I mean, it's really incredible. Like you said, Gwendolyn Midloe Hall, I found out about her on Afropop, and it's just amazing. I think that the title, The Half, has never been told. You know, like I said, that was important, is that, you know, we only get a certain portion of slavery, and the half hasn't even been told, man. Like, it was a real codified system, you know. So I just was wondering if you had peeped that out, man. Like, on Afropop, man, like, it's a lot of scholarship going down. White people are putting it down, man. So it's really crazy. Like, if they're saying that the half has never been told, we really don't know what was going on. And I think we downplay the whole experience, man. Like, we know it, but these are white people, man, serious scholars, man, saying that the half has never been told, that, you know, basically black people haven't really been studied like they you know, like they would have been, you know, and now they're coming out with all of this stuff, you know, because people that's trying to go for reparations, have you ever heard like of the Middle Passage where they were saying like all these millions and millions of black people in the Middle Passage had died and stuff like that? They never bring up, you know, like you know, that as much the African slave coast in the you know, the buy Negro signs and how breeding was going on. So like these numbers are even through this scholarship is changing, you know. It's, so that whole debate, I don't know, man. It's just I was just thinking like, you know, let's move on. I think we really got to meditate on these works, man. The Half Has Never Been Told in the African Slave Coast. Through all of what we've been hearing through the years, all these different arguments and whatnot, I think we don't want to move on too quickly. I think we really need to it's so much that you can peep out just on, you know, so much to meditate on and think about, and I think we need to meditate and think about some of these works that's coming out and what it means and how it's changing our paradigm from what we've been told and what we're learning now. And the half has never been told, so it's even more that we don't even know about. So, that's crazy. Like,
I would agree. I would, I guess for the people who accurately, I agree, the people that are saying, you know, this was like a horror read, even though they, you know, folks said it was constructive and what have you, and they got good information. I've said it consistently, the American Slave Coast, the Sublets, white authors, they were on the program. I think that is a better book, having read this book cover to cover and having read that book cover to cover. That is a better book, even though I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with this book other than the typical, you know, things that we would point out from a white author. It references this book and it makes most, if not all, of the same points, black people being the bank and how this black people were the banking system. That was the financial system for this area of the world, for the whole world. In fact, that book, in my view, it might be a better book because it makes central the rape of black females is like the primary point of the book. And so it would be like this book, but that rape of black bodies being central as you go from like 1500 all the way through Civil War. It's roughly the same size. It might be a little bit bigger. You know, but it is very, very good. It has a lot of detailed firsthand accounts. And I mean, he makes that argument by just going back and you get primary sources of white people talking about how raping black bodies, that is our system. That's how we're going to make money. Just continuing to rape black people and making them reproduce and then selling them or whatever else we want to do, with the offspring. They're just linked, as I said, he references this book repeatedly in that one, and it's pretty much covering the same period of time and all that. I read them at the same time, so they'll be linked for me moving forward. But I would definitely recommend highly people check that book out and, as was just said, meditate on some of the things that are shared. You can even go back and check out the program where we touched on where they said that the rape of black people is fundamental to white culture. They both agreed to that on the program, and I would submit their book as Exhibit A. Some of the things quickly that stood out for me, reparations was brought up. They compensated white slave owners in Washington, D.C., setting aside $1 million to compensate them. They compensated in England. They compensated all of the slave owners when they abolished the slave trade. They all got compensation. That should be brought out when people talk about whether or not black people should get any sort of compensation, reparations for what we have endured, that the enslavers have been compensated. Surely if you can compensate raping terrorists, surely you can compensate their victims and descendants. Not that I've said this consistently, that to me the whole reparations thing is I see the logic in people saying that we, you know, are deserving of something, but I just don't see how that would solve any problems if there's if racists are going to continue to terrorize us, you just have to update the reparations every 50 years or 20 years or what have you to take in all the abuse that has been doled out since the last round of reparations, quote unquote. The next thing, when they said that the slaves had to demonstrate to union officials a disposition to work. I mean, that is astounding. Like, I am an enslaved black person. I've been beat. They have literally created whipping machines. And I have to demonstrate to some white person that I have a disposition to work in order to be fed. Are you kidding me? Like, we're continuing where they said that they were talking about making a policy to enlist black people to fight for the union, but white people didn't really want that. And he even goes on to say that many whites feared, they feared even more that Frederick Douglass had been right when he insisted that let the black man get upon his person the brass letters U.S., a musket on his shoulder and bullets in his pocket, and there's no power on earth or under the earth which can deny that he has earned the right of citizenship in the United States. That, I thought, was extremely important. Why would white people be fearful? We have this war, massive casualties, hundreds of thousands of deaths at a time where you did not have a massive population in the country. Who would be opposed to that? I don't want to go fight and die. I don't want my children to be sent off and fight. Let the Negroes go. The fact that they did not want that, to me, says a lot about the depths of white supremacy, and that you see this sentiment play out for decades, where white people, we had Black Soldier Blues, the filmmaker, she was in Australia, no less, and she talked about how blacks in World War II, they wouldn't even give them guns. They had them sitting out to defend against the Japanese army with sticks, where they could see Japanese, armed Japanese opposition, and they've got a stick in their hand because whites didn't want to give them a gun. And you had this same rhetoric then: if we go and fight and die, then that'll prove our worth to white people and our that we are worthy of U.S. citizenship and everything that's supposed to come with it. And you just, that does not happen at all. This plays out at Vietnam over and over and over and over. World War One as well. But I think, at least in my mind, that reveals a lot about what it means to be a white person, North, South, worldwide. Great pictures. Said again, they have some great pictures in this section as well. I don't know what type of choice that is. I think frequently racists, one of their major weapons is to give you the illusion of choice. You can choose Donald Trump, or you can choose Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, where they say you can choose to go to the Bonnie Carey and do plantation labor, or you can serve in the U.S. Army. What kind of choice is that, to continue doing what I've been doing, slave work, or I can go fight and die in your racist Union Army? Are you joking? Continuing downward, says that the soldiers drove us like cattle, but T later remembered. Not surprised at all. I think Mr. Demery Ford talked about that. Black people, of course, are going to be given the worst tasks on these quote-unquote government farms and burying dead soldiers and what have you, making latrines where whites can go use the toilet. Again, great images, pictures. If anybody, if you go to a library or a bookstore, it might be worth picking this book up just to kind of flip through and look at some of the illustrations. I had a round of applause when they talked about the enslaved white enslavers committing suicide once they lost the war. I thought it was interesting. He had no problem, Edward Baptist. He had no problem identifying Vice President Andrew Johnson as a racist who has been on undermining emancipation. But took offense to people identifying Abraham Lincoln as a racist. That's been something that I also try to point out. When white people, they will be comfortable identifying Donald Trump as a racist. They'll be comfortable identifying someone like Rush Limbaugh or Paula Deen or Donald Sterling as a racist, but they will not identify someone like Bernie Sanders as a racist, trying to make it seem that there are good, well-meaning whites. That just further causes confusion, I think, for a lot of victims. Let's see. I thought just a whole lot in the last section, I thought there was a lot of flowery rhetoric that really served to minimize the ongoing system regime of white terrorism, where he's saying that this, you know, opened the door to radically change things and allow descendants of slaves and immigrants alike to undermine racial and cultural supremacy. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about white supremacy. Call it what it is. He goes on to say this throughout the whole segment, where there were many times where I was almost highlighting everything. Like, this is just typical racist rhetoric and really downplaying and pussyfooting what it is we're talking about. And I mean, you want to talk about the half has never been told. Talking and making an honest assessment of the terrorism that ensued 1865 to present, I think a lot of that is not told either. Richard Williams, when he talks about what happened to his family, that was 20th century, not pre-Civil War. And I think a lot of other people, a lot of the information that's in Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Sun, the book that we're going to talk about on Monday, Virginia Christian, black female, sentenced to death for killing her white female boss who was beating her, oppressing her. That happened in the 20th century. A lot of that even has not been accurately accounted. Some of the other texts that we've had on this program, Texas Tough, talking about the rise of the prison empire in this area of the world, all of that is 20th century, well after quote-unquote emancipation. I just see that as a general tendency where whites really minimize and downplay accurate information about what we're dealing with and just trying to localize that to 19th century white conduct and 19th century Southern white conduct at that. Then he talks about convincing majority of white Americans, including most historians, that slavery had been benign and that states' rights had been the cause of the Civil War, yet the Kingdom of the South white lords had regained was a starved one. They themselves were much poorer than they had been. Their violence was more self-destructive, less profitable. I thought that was significant because I think white people are lying to us. I think white people, they are very aware. It's been my experience that that's not like hidden history. Most white people, they're very aware that white people were fighting for slavery. Again, a white man wrote this book. He did reference a lot of the reference materials that he had. It's books written by other white people. I think white people are very aware. The documents are pretty clear with them stating why they were leaving and what the deal was in terms of why they needed to fight this war and kill hundreds of thousands of people. I think white people just do a very good job of lying to us so that we get further confused about things, and then you waste a lot of time arguing with them. It goes back and forth, and they'll just write tons and tons of books going back and forth. It was about slavery. No, it wasn't about slavery, which is, you know, just a waste of time. They're very clear. They're not confused about this. He had another passage where it was kind of the same thing, where he says, stolen from them. Yeah, I thought where he did at least make it clear in terms of black people not having the same amount of wealth as whites, regardless of whether they own slaves or not, being clear. And I would say not just vestiges of racism, white supremacy, but ongoing. When this, as I said, I think a great book to pick up after this one is Ben Tillman, Reconstruction of White Supremacy, where you see the continuation of that terrorism, whites bragging about killing black people and what have you. Glad that we covered that book before. I thought it was a pretty major act of racism, in my opinion, where he says, talking about black people, they changed the South and the United States and the world forever through the Civil Rights Movement, and they built a tradition of community organization that eventually led the American electorate in an astonishing development to elect a black president who was the son of an African immigrant. As a political force, the solidarity that African Americans built while still enslaved remains impressively coherent. That, I thought, I mean, it is so astronomically inaccurate. Racists do this sort of thing when Mr. Fuller says that they will say false things to kind of inflate our sense of power. That, I mean, just those two words, talking about black people as a political force. Are you joking? Black people elected President Barack Obama. Are you joking? Are you just lying and trying to make me feel good? Like, yeah, we did that. Our political force was on display. If so, we have done a really poor job of exercising that political force the 8 years that he's been in office if we put him here. Certainly, I do not take that position. White people are responsible for him being there. I have no idea even what he's talking about, or anyone for that matter, to even utter a phrase, black political force. in this area of the world, that just, it does not compute at all. My brain computer nearly exploded when that paragraph was read. And I felt like the whole ending chapter of the book was like, it was just filled with a lot of this just total racist nonsense where maybe some black people would feel good. But I mean, I'm not about feeling good. We should be about truth. Accuracy. That's what's going to solve the problem. And this sort of just total racist folly is not going to help us solving problems. Lying to ourselves about the amount of power that we have in relation to white people. 1860, 1960, 2160. He had another portion that was at the top of the same page where he says black people talking, make sure I get the whole thing, where he says a precedent that would grow in leverage as the century, that word again, leverage, as the century went on and the United States found itself up against enemies eager to point the hypocrisy of first-class language and second-class practice of civil and political equality. They, talking about black people, with white allies, created in the form of abolitionism the ideological template of American descent, of progressivism, of the faith that social change pursued with a religious zeal could make America truer to its ideal self. I think Ross brought this up as well. And I thought that was the whole point of the book, Slavery and the Making of American Capitalism, that is what this area of the world has been fundamentally about, raping, pillaging black people and divvying up their bodies for white dominion, white power. I thought that was the whole point of the book. So I didn't agree with that either. And I just felt that that was in line with the whole racist rhetoric that kind of concluded the text. I think I'm satisfied wrapping there. We did our three and extra. Anybody have, I guess, a concluding thought, anything they needed to make sure they get in before we wrap things up?
Yes, I did. I was thinking about the section that Mr. Denley brought up in regards to Liza, where it says on page 401, because Liza had been in the Confederate zone, the proclamation officially freed her. But after being disembarked on the New Orleans levee, she and others were herded into the city's cotton warehouses. From there, Liza remembered decades later, we were all scattered about to different Union-controlled plantations to do forced labor. And it really made me think of Dr. John Henry Clark. He's always talked about the fact, and I just thought about, hey, freedom and under a system of racism, white supremacy is never freedom. It's just a more reformed version of racism, white supremacy. And Dr. Clark always used to say that black people should never give the ability to free us to our enemies, because it will always be to the benefit of those enemies. Freedom has to be taken by the oppressed, and they create the freedom that the way they wish for it to be, not the way that the enslaver or the racist white supremacist wants it to be for them. Also, I thought about what you and 909 was talking about, and again, congratulations to your relative, about really tapping into speaking to your elders, because in my family, it was really interesting. My father-in-law ended up just in confidence one day, and this is something he never discussed with anyone else. I found out later. I was just asking him questions and about what life was like for him, because he's now 87 and he suffers from dementia. And he actually told me, he said segregation was actually better for us. And he had said the reason why was because when he was growing up in the Trenton area in New Jersey, black people had their own schools. They had everything. He said it wasn't the best of facilities, but the idea was that every day you woke up, you were basically isolated in a big way from having to deal with white people on an everyday basis. And then he also discussed the fact that there was a big story of a racist incident that took place in the state of New Jersey called the Trenton Six. And he's related to three of the guys who were involved in that incident. And none of this would have come out had I not been having a discussion with him. And then also the information that 909 brought up about pondering what we don't know about what has happened to our ancestors. It's really, really true to think about that. We have to really sit and think about that and not be ashamed of it, because there's nothing for us to be ashamed of. We were victimized and we're still being victimized. And I think that's the biggest issue for us as a people, is to get past the feeling of shame, because that's another aspect of racism, white supremacy, that white people have placed on us psychologically. And we really have to look past that to understand the type of beings that we're dealing with. And I would just put out there, again, the great book to read that'll help understand what our ancestors went through. It's called Kebuka by Umwelinu Baruti. It's a phenomenal book. It's very brief, but I think it'll be a life-changing book for anyone who gets their hands on it. I thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
Anything else want to make folks want to make sure they get in before we conclude? Last thought. We have about 2 minutes.
I love that word leverage as far as understanding racism, white supremacy. When I think of leverage, I think of like a crowbar. I just was wondering if people really understood like leverage, like in flesh and blood sense, where, it's white people have used leverage. I don't know. I guess I want to say like logical fallacies. Like when you read in, I know Thomas in New York, he always brings out like some of the, he's like, oh, they're practicing white supremacy right there and stuff like that. You know, being able to recognize some of the logical fallacies that you brought out as far as, political force and all that stuff that they put in. I don't know who they write that stuff for, I think that'll be interesting for you, Thomas, if you wanted to like just really get into the logical fallacies and help people understand, because you always be pointing out. I love that you always point out things that where they are practicing racism. Like this stuff don't even make no sense. You know, that's, you know, I don't see how they could write that, and they're so intelligent. And leverage. I think if you really understand leverage, you start seeing how a lot of our so-called institutions get co-opted or infiltrated, and they use leverage against us heavily. Like that's one of the major they understand leverage, and so like just the fact that word has been brought out, I wanted to kind of just put some extra on that. Understand that.
Right on. We will wrap things up there. If folks have any other thoughts, I had been thinking about getting inviting Mr. Baptist on the program, but since it's such a lengthy book, I wanted to wait until we were closer to the end or had in fact read the book. Then it would be better for people to, if they were interested in asking questions and all that. Now we've covered the whole book, so I will put that in the cap and ponder. It might be cool to invite him to the program to see if he'd be willing to come and chat it up with us to discuss his book and some of the points, quality information, and points where, you know, in my view, his racism is coming through. But we'll ponder on that one. Again, if black females specifically would be interested in narrating Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, let me know. Certainly you would have to be able to narrate the first installment for next Friday, which would probably entail making sure you have your hand on the book sometime soon and then able to actually do the audio in roughly a week's time. You can drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you are interested. If not, I will do the reading for next week. But I'm about 85% certain that'll be the book that we start next Friday. With that, we should be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on news events from the last 7 days. We should be here on Monday. I mentioned Virginia Christian, a black female who was given the death penalty for killing her white female employer in Virginia. This is in the 20th century. And they actually start the book talking about Nat Turner. This is in Virginia, but talking about how that was still weighing on the white Virginian mind in the great Commonwealth. And how they thought about black people and making sure, you know, can't have a repeat of 1831 Virginia, Southampton. But the white author, this book on Virginia Christian, Forsaken, he will be with us Monday. Now, the book that he wrote is fiction, but it is obviously based on actual historical events. So looking forward to that. Played the news clip a few weeks back. If folks are interested, want to do your research and prep for him, he'll be here Monday, normal broadcast time. If you have any questions, gripes, complaints, suggestions, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks for all the folks who tuned in and participated. I hope the month or months really that we invested in this book, I hope, you know, it has been of some benefit and you got some constructive details that you can share and utilize, help you get a better grasp of racism, white supremacy, what it means to be white. With that, creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.